to what you have to get away.
I am delighted to call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. We have a very busy agenda. We have a new member of the committee who I think is not here yet. Is that right?
Correct.
He'll be along. We'll start off by embarrassing him. I'm going to open an informational meeting on issues around Cover Oregon and the transition. And I'm going to call Ms. Edlin to the speaker's platform.
Thank you.
To talk about the transition, and after that, Aaron Padnode and anybody who he wants to have as wingmen.
Yes.
It's very rude to come late to your very first meeting.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. It's not off to a good start for my first one.
If you'll just hold on a minute, would you introduce yourself?
Sure. Do I have to say for the record and all that stuff?
No, you are on the record now.
Right,
as long as the blue light over there is on, you're on the record.
Okay. I'm Representative Rob Nose. I'm taking Representative Jules Bailey's place from Southeast Portland, House District 42. Happy to be here. Okay. Sorry I'm late.
Happy to have you. Ms. Edlin.
Okay. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tina Edlin. I'm the IT Transition Project Director. I work in the Office of the Governor. I'm here today just to give you a really brief update on how things are going with the transition of Cover Oregon's technology to the federal government for commercial enrollments and back to the Oregon Health Authority on the Medicaid side. So the goals of the project are pretty much what I just said, that Oregonians on November 15th, 2014, Oregonians who are eligible for tax credits on the private side have a place to go at healthcare.gov to not only have their to apply to have their eligibility determined, but to also shop and get their tax credits determined. Oregonians eligible for Medicaid will have a more streamlined process to apply online. To accomplish this goal, what we're doing is using the federal technology on the private side, as I said. On the Medicaid side, we've actually made some adjustments. The original goal was to have the Medicaid rules engine moved completely over from Cover Oregon to Oregon Health Authority by November 15th. But because we needed some additional services that our vendor declined to offer to us, we decided to...
Which vendor was that?
Was Oracle. We made the decision to move equipment, basically, from Utah and from Texas to Oregon a little sooner than originally planned. And that actually delays some implementation of technology. So what we have done is we will be using healthcare.gov for the Medicaid side as well, for people who are eligible for Medicaid because of income. They can also use healthcare.gov. We have established a landing page with screening questions so that Medicaid clients can really determine the best place for them to go. They can complete the fillable PDF on our side, on the OHA side, or go to healthcare.gov. It's their choice once they go through the screening questions.
Can I ask clarification?
Uh-huh.
So the number 2, is that still appropriate?
Or yes, it is. This is the corrected number 2.
But you're starting now, not November 15th?
Well, no, it all starts November 15th. That's when this all goes into effect, is implemented, is November 15th. Yeah, thank you for asking that. I think it's one thing that I want to make sure people understand is that while the move on the private insurance to the federal technology is a permanent move, there's no contemplation of coming back to develop IT systems to enroll in private health care coverage through through the health insurance exchange. The move to use it on the Medicaid side is only for 1 year. It was basically a temporary opportunity that CMS offered us to help us out through this period of time. So it's just 1 year on the Medicaid side. And that's primarily because Medicaid is considered, it's actually in law, it's an obligation of the state Medicaid eligibility and enrollment. So that's the reason it's a 1 year mitigation. So the project update is we're on track for the new landing page with the screening questions. It's OregonHealthcare.gov, and this is primarily for Medicaid. As I said, people eligible or who think they might be eligible for Medicaid can come there, answer the screening questions, and determine where they might have the best experience. The transition of commercial enrollment is completely on track. I don't want anyone to think that the adjustments we've made affect that at all. I'll update at a little bit of detail here in a minute about that. And then the transition of Medicaid, again, on November 15th, there won't be any interruption that anyone will see. It's just that people will have this additional opportunity going to healthcare.gov. So the key components of moving the commercial enrollment to healthcare.gov, it's really important to understand that this isn't a technology project on that side. This is really the carriers, the 15 carriers who are participating in the health insurance exchange are moving from Cover Oregon to the federal marketplace. So it's really shifts from a relationship with us to a relationship between the carriers and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I will update where that is in just a minute. So it's really updating their business processes to be working with the federal government and working directly with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So this is just an example. Well, there's many ways, and I'll talk about this at the very end, that we track this project. And this is one of the ways that we do it. Every week, the project staff tracks where we are against deliverables. So you can see that on this is the QHP side, the qualified health plan, the private side. We are completely on track. We've met all of our deliverables. Things are going along as originally planned. The plans are getting on what they call onboarded to the federal exchange. The current project status of the 15 carriers who are participating in the exchange. This says 10 carriers have onboarded to the federal marketplace successfully. Two more onboarded at the end of last week. So it's 12. Three are in process. And what our job is to make sure that's a warm handoff. Make sure that people at CMS, their account managers at CMS, are working with them and making sure that it all happens smoothly. On the MAGI, this is the MAGI Medicaid transition project, and what you'll notice, and this is where we've had to make some adjustments in the timing of things, it will still have the same goals, they'll just happen in different time periods. And that's the reason you see the box with the inset box on the right-hand side of the timeline, because we're resetting the dates for deliverables on this project. The project has, because we've instituted these mitigations, the project has moved from red for scope and schedule back to yellow. Obviously, there's risk with any large IT project, but we have been doing mitigation planning from the very beginning of the project, and we're ready to institute the necessary adjustments to make sure we hit the November 15th date. So what we've done on the OHP side, the Oregon Health Plan side, is development has been stopped for anything that's dependent on Oracle. We've improved, we think we've actually improved the plan by this opportunity that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has offered us. It actually reduces some workload for people who would have to come in and do full applications. It actually now doesn't necessarily go through the OHA process, but will go through healthcare.gov. We've estimated there's about 25,000 new applications a month that would actually be able to use this process while we're continuing continuing to complete the project over in OHA. The fillable PDF that we talk so much about and hear so much about is still in place for some populations. This is the better solution. Pregnant women, for instance, there's a process in place to get them connected to services very, very quickly, and that we feel like is still going to be, even though it's just a fillable PDF, we feel like it's a better experience for them. November 15th, the current enrollment and redetermination process still goes on just as it does today. None of that changes. And then people who find out through the application process with us that they're actually eligible for a tax credit and not Medicaid will be directed to healthcare.gov.
Tina, can we go back a moment to what you just said?
Yeah.
The Medicaid population, as opposed to the private population, does not have to re-enroll.
That's
that
right.
Correct?
The Medicaid population does not have to re-enroll.
They'll go through the normal annual...
That's right. That's right.
Thank reassessment,
you. Yes.
But they're not a part of having to...
No.
The 300...
No.
The million... Won't have to do anything.
Oh, that's right.
To this.
That's right. Just on their annual redetermination date, they do the clients in Medicaid will be redetermined just as they are now. It's the same process.
But the commercial side re-enrolls every year.
The commercial side, because of the move to healthcare.gov, that's because Representative Kenny Geyer. That's because the only way that we couldn't do a bulk transfer of data because you have to prove people's identity, mm-hmm. and the only person who can prove your identity is yourself. It really happens at the individual level. Mm-hmm. So there was really no way to get around that requirement. And actually, I think that for the individuals involved, it's probably better to be in control of that piece of it. So we're going to do everything we can to reach out to them, make sure they understand what they need to do between November 15th and actually December 15th if they want January 1 coverage. So there are plans in place to make sure that they're contacted in several different ways so that happens smoothly. This is just an updated project plan. It shows how we have moved everything out so that by August of 2015 we'll shift back off of Oregon Health, of healthcare.gov and to applying online through the Oregon Health Authority. And this, I just wanted to remind people of the different ways that we really are accountable for this project and how we report on this project. It's not only how we change how we do business. We have a deliverables-based contract with Deloitte. We've hired the system integrator. We have a single point of accountability, which is me. A lot of those changes, but we've also put in a lot of monitoring in this that I think is really important. We have an interagency advisory committee that I meet with every week. They act as a steering committee. They actually have decision-making authority at certain go-forward points in the project plan. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, I talk to them at least 3 times a week where we jointly we keep them updated in progress. Legislative Fiscal Office. Maximus is our external quality review vendor, and they perform quarterly risk assessments as well as monthly quality control reports. All of this is available, and I want to make sure that everyone knows this because I think it is important for people to be able to follow along. This, I really have focused on the idea of transparency in this project and post almost every piece of paper that comes across my desk ends up here somehow or another. This is a really long URL. You can get there by going to coveroregon.com and just clicking on the transition project. And you'll see all of the weekly status reports, all the regular progress reports that are done, and evaluations of the project. So with that, that's just a quick update. I can take any questions.
Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
Tina, thank you for the presentation. Just out of curiosity, how many people are working on, specifically on the technology transition right now?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, I actually am going to have to go get that number for you. I, I actually don't know off the top of my head what the number is, people working on the transition. What we did was we have built a team of, it's people who actually, this is their regular job in the Oregon Health Authority. They're people where this is their regular job over in Cover Oregon, and they've come together in this team. Then there are people that we've actually rotated off of their regular positions to do this work. So I will get that for you, though. I actually knew at one time. I just don't remember off the top of my head right now.
Okay, no worries. I wasn't trying to put you on the spot, but may I follow up?
Yeah, but let's follow that. Is this a huge number or a small number?
Oh, no,
we're talking about
100
people.
10, 20, 100.
It's more like probably 25, I want to say, and that's the total. That's the technology side. That's the business people. That's everybody all in working on this.
And this is, you're primarily responsible for the technology transition to the federal website. Once that is done, what are you going to do?
He's going to retire.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, members of the committee, I probably am going to retire.
He's put up with a lot of bad bosses, including me, over time.
I
know. She admitted to that.
You deserve a medal for that.
Tina, I'll have the final question. We have worked together for a long time,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I have a lot of confidence in things you say. Is this going to work?
So the healthcare.gov.
Small question.
Well, first of all, I mean, I think it's important to remember that the move to healthcare.gov is a move to a working technology. It's working right now for 34 states. There's no reason to believe that it's not going to work for us as well. And we have mitigation plans. If for some reason it goes down for an hour or 2 hours or a day, we have mitigation plans in place. On the Medicaid side, We're building on technology that has been working since January. The rules engine has been in place and been working. We obviously have some challenges in making the actual move from Oracle to our own state data center. But again, I feel confident that we will get there by that August date.
Thank you very much.
Well, I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, this would probably be for you, and I don't know if Tina would be the appropriate one for it, but I'd be kind of curious to see what we would have done to insurance premiums if we would have never done Cover Oregon and used that money actually for providing services to patients. So with the total amount that we had, I bet you we'd find we would have dropped insurance premiums probably by 30%.
Yeah, if the federal government would have given the money to spend us the way we wanted, but I think that wasn't a very likely possibility. Tina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work. Ms. Patna, will you join us? And anybody you want to fly wing with you? Tina, I know, has another appointment, so that's why she was on first. While you're getting ready, let me just make a couple of opening comments. As the lawyers would say, a couple of stipulations. I think one stipulation we can make is everybody involved, everybody at this table, everybody in the building, your staff, all your people, have one objective, and that's to make sure Oregonians can get affordable and effective health care. And so far we've added several between the two systems, but we know that's where we're going. There have been a lot of calls in this building for a dramatic move in Cover Oregon. We've heard from the governor, the speaker, the president, the Minority Caucus, a variety of people with ideas. The fact is, we're not talking about those ideas today. This is premature. There are issues for the next session. What we're talking about today is what's going on right now. And I've asked Mr. Patino to deal with at least two things, although others of you may want to ask him about other things. So the two things we've asked him to deal with specifically, besides an overall perspective of where things are, is the question of the premium tax credit calculation that caused some problems. We're sort of curious about where it came from and what the magnitude of the problem is, and I think we'll have some interesting information on that. Any of you may have gotten a preview of this from the testimony this morning, which will be the rerun of that of that material. And I've also, I'm assuming that for operational purposes, we have to believe that Cover Oregon will be with us for most, if not all, of 2015. If that's the case, I've asked Mr. Patino to get us some estimate of what the operational budget would be, where the money will come from, what they might do with it, and get some sense of where that is. And that's, this, I think, the second topic. I don't know whether you have any other topics than that, but you'll likely hear from us about some other topics as well. So,
no, Chair Greenlick, I think that's a nice framing of what I'll be covering today. So, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. For the record, my name is Aaron Patino. I'm Executive Director of Cover Oregon, Oregon's health insurance marketplace. What I'll be covering today is a brief update on Cover Oregon's recent activities, covering a number of the topics that Chair Greenlick just mentioned. Again, so today I'll look at two specific sections, one related to 2014, one related to 2015. And the 2014 section will provide a brief update on the enrollment numbers to ensure that you all have the most up-to-date information regarding enrollments, some of the progress and challenges, and as Chair Greenlick alluded to, a discussion about the advanced premium tax credit that came to light recently. For 2015, we'll talk about our transition to the supported state-based marketplace that dovetails nicely with what Tina just presented, the revenue projections for Cover Oregon, and how we will be going about our budgeting for 2015 and 2016. Whoops, sorry. So a nice picture of a family here as we jump into 2014. So from an enrollment perspective, for as it relates to Cover Oregon, that's the top table. So Cover Oregon, total medical enrollments, 353,454 individuals and families have successfully come through Cover Oregon to enroll in coverage. 101,092 of those individuals and families are commercial families, and 252,362 represent the population that were Medicaid eligible that enrolled through Cover Oregon. In addition to those medical enrollments, we also have over 20,000 dental enrollments. The Oregon Health Authority also had a fast-track process to enroll members, and that was responsible for 138,955 enrollees. So when you sum those together, not including the dental enrollments, the total medical enrollments for 2014 between Cover Oregon, OHA, including the fast-track, is 492,409. So 101,000 commercial enrollments with a hybrid, largely manual process is something that the state should celebrate, given in relation to other states that have either state-based marketplace or a federally facilitated marketplace. All of these numbers put us about middle of the pack in comparison to how the other states have done. So the next slide,
Just wondering why dental is broken out. What is the process for enrollment in dental?
So Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, dental is broken out as consumers can actually purchase a standalone dental product through the exchange as well.
So some people have combined and you don't see the dental, their dental if it's combined, and
that's correct.
Just the standalone.
That's correct. So from a net enrollment or effectuation perspective, so net qualified health plan enrollments, that's QHP, these are our commercial members, represent 78,616. And the number of lives that are actually effectuated on those net enrollments is 67,479. So
what does that mean?
So yeah. Chair Greenlick, that was my next clarification is an effectuated policy is one that represents a premium whose first month has been paid. So the 78,000 number is our net of the 101,000 shown on the previous slide, which is the gross. 67,479 of that number have paid their first month's premium, which in effect has effectuated their policy. And that represents an effectuation rate of about 86%. And an industry standard on the insurance side is between 80 and 90%.
Can I ask one more question? On the previous slide, you had the qualified health plan enrollments at 101,000.
Correct.
So what's the difference between the 78? And
so, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, the 101,092 is the gross of how many commercial members have gone to the exchange, selected a plan, and began the process of enrolling in coverage. In order for those individuals to become effectuated, they are required to make their first month's payment, which gets us to the 67,479 number.
I'm wondering that on the previous page it said enrollments 101,
mm-hmm.
and then that says net enrollments 101. Is there, is the 101?
No, 78.
I mean 78,000.
What's
so what happened to 25,000
right?
people between the gross and the net? Because this is separate from effectuated.
So, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, this is one of the nuances of how insurance is sold mm-hmm. across the country, not just in our state. But the intent to purchase an insurance product does not mean that that person ultimately will become enrolled in that product. So there's a point where the work with the consumer is done with Cover Oregon, and then it becomes work between the carrier and the consumer to make the payment on that policy.
So the 101 are the people that started the process. The 78 are the people
Can
that completed
this,
the process.
Private minute, if yeah. you would explain it.
Yeah. And the Let's third see. One is just who paid for the process.
That's correct.
Is that it?
That's okay. correct. And we can work to further clarify these numbers at a later date. So as it relates to progress and challenges specific to 2014, I've highlighted three of our major buckets, if you will, on this slide. So agent commission processing. So at this point in time, or sorry, as of August 31st, 2014, which was the last time we performed a reconciliation, we have reconciled 95% of the deposits that have been paid to Cover Oregon for work on behalf of agents and brokers, or work that brokers and agents have done on behalf of Cover Oregon. Just in the month of August, we distributed over $1 million, which was our largest disbursement to date. So our goal as an organization remains to become 100% on this reconciliation to ensure that all the brokers and agents that have done work on behalf of Cover Oregon are compensated for that work. QHP life change requests. These are instances where somebody who has purchased a product has a birth or an addition to their family or a marriage or a divorce. Something that would open a special enrollment period. So since June 20th, Cover Oregon has processed over 13,000 of these life change requests. And as of September 11th, we have 821 of those to complete, and we average about 150 new life change requests a day. So eventually our goal as the organization is to become current on those and only process those that come into us on a daily basis. So given the technology challenges that we've had, the backlog built up, and we've been working on processing through those to the point where we are today.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question specific to that? Are you trying to hold questions till the
yeah,
end?
Yeah, brief ones.
Yeah, this is brief. Is that a permanent function of Cover Oregon even after the transition to the federal website? You'll continue to be hand processing these, what you're calling life change requests. So is that intended to be a perpetual function of Cover Oregon?
So, Chair Green, like members of the committee, the answer to that is no. So this activity will only pertain to the 2014 application process. So, and it's important to remember that there will be a period of 2014 that overlaps with the 2015 open enrollment period. So Cover Oregon, in essence, will have to continue to process these changes into the beginning of 2015 for 2014 coverage to be reconciled. For 2015, all of this work will be handled through the federal technology, and I have a table that explains that later.
Thank you.
Case corrections are similar to change of life requests in that these are data errors, if you will, to somebody's application that needed to be corrected or reconciled. So we have processed 4,161 of these corrections since June 20th, and as of September 11th, we have 880 still in the queue. Again, our goal is to have this number reduced to zero. This is not one of those errors that will continue on in a perpetuity similar to the other one where we get 150 new requests a day. So the next slide is related to the advanced premium tax credit. But as opposed to reading through the words on this slide, I'd like to reference this handout that you all should have in front of you. It's got a blue bar and a green bar on it about halfway down the page. This is the most recent up-to-date information we have on the advanced premium tax credit issue that's been identified. So for those of you who aren't aware of the issue as of yet, Cover Oregon discovered an error in the computation of the advanced premium tax credit, which we refer to as the APTC, that affects approximately 2% of the 42 households receiving the APTC. So the impact on most households is approximately $2 per month, and a small number may see more significant impacts. Cover Oregon will notify everyone affected by this error and will adjust their monthly tax credit amount for the remainder of the year. The calculation error has been corrected for future customers. So a couple bullets before I get into a more specific explanation of what this error is. So premium tax credits are available to people with incomes below 400% of the federal poverty level. They're calculated for each applicant using several factors, including the cost of the federally mandated essential health benefits portion of the premium costs. Those are mandated benefits that every insurance product are required to have for sale in 2014. And the person's income also weighs into the value of that advanced premium tax credit. Consumers can choose to use some or all of their tax credits in the advanced premium tax credit to reduce their monthly premium, or they can choose to defer that advanced premium tax credit to April when it will be reconciled with their federal filing, their federal tax filing. And also, finally, advanced premium tax credits are based on projected income and are reconciled at tax filing. So
if they defer it, they'll pay the full premium.
That's correct. If they defer the advanced premium tax credit to tax filing, they will pay on the monthly basis the full value of the premium.
And then get a return on their...
Chair Greenlick, that's correct.
They never do that.
So on the bottom half of the first page is an example of the problem, and I'll start with the top box, if you will. So and this example is hypothetical. We didn't pull a specific case. We wanted to make it easier for folks to understand, and this was the easiest way for us to do that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So for a couple making $30,000 a year, their maximum contribution to their premium based upon that income would be $150 per month. So the second two pieces of that top bar represent two different plans that that family could have purchased. So the first one that's listed as the benchmark plan is a plan that is comprised of 100% those essential health benefits, so those 10 categories that are required to be included in every insurance product that's sold in the market for 2014. And the value of that product would be, the premium would be, premium cost would be $620.55. If you deduct the maximum contribution for that family, it leaves $470.55 that the advanced premium tax credit would be allowed to cover. Comparing that to the next column over that says plan selected with 99.5% EHB, that plan would cost $465, and if the APTC provided would be $465, the amount covered by the advanced premium tax credit would be $462, and that should say 82 cents, which is 99.5% of that product that was built. So you can see, if you look below in the next column, with the green bar, you can see a 0.5% above that 99.5% would represent benefits that aren't covered by the advanced premium tax credit, things like chiropractic, acupuncture services, whatnot. I'll call them non-essential health benefits. The error that Cover Oregon has been making on the application of the advanced premium tax credit is that as opposed to applying that advanced premium tax credit to only the $462.82 in the green column, we have been applying the advanced premium tax credit to the total value of that premium, which is incorrect. So there was an error in how we've been applying it. That being said, in this example with the green bar, the error, as you can see in the small box on the bottom of the page, would be that Cover Oregon has paid $2.28 too much tax credit to this consumer over the course of however long they've had the product. So hypothetically, if they've had the product for 10 months over the course of the year, we will have overpaid the consumer $22.82 for that product that they've purchased. So that's an explanation of the error. Let me go into the numbers surrounding the size of the impact of this error, so we can better understand it. And before I get into this, I just want to underscore the fact that we've been appropriately cautious with our evaluation of this error. and making sure that, number one, we properly service the people that have come to depend on us for their insurance coverage, and number two, that we don't cause alarm in the communities for people that may be impacted by this. So our starting point was the total number of households who are actually eligible for advanced premium tax credits, so those people who live between 138 and 400% of the federal poverty level. And that number is 42,367 tax-paying households. This isn't individuals. We do it on a household basis. So at this point in time, we've reviewed 92% of that number. So out of the 39,000 individual and family records we have reviewed, 775 cases included the error that I just walked through with you. That's less than 2% of those cases that we've analyzed so far. The remaining 8% that we have left to analyze are more complex cases and only require more time to go through, as these households may have had changes in which plan they selected. They just require a little more hand-holding, if you will, for us to analyze. That being said, out of the 92% of these cases that we impacted, and ultimately the 775 cases that have the error, 62% of those cases, the error is less than $2 per month. 27% have errors in the $2 to $12 per month range. 6% have errors in the $12 to $100 month range. And 4% had errors over $100 per month. So the remaining work is doing the analysis on that final 8% that we have yet to review. And that represents 3,361 individual and family records that are still under review. There's nothing that leads us to believe the error rate that we've seen in the first 92% will be any different in the rate in this last 8% that we're reviewing. However, if we extrapolate out the error rate that we've seen in the 92%, the total ballpark number of lives that could be impacted by this is right around 850, of tax-paying households. So what are we doing about this error? So Cover Oregon will contact all the consumers affected by this tax credit error. So it's our responsibility as the organization that made the error in the first place to communicate with the people and families that have been impacted by it. The amount of the tax credit given to the affected households will be adjusted to the correct amount. This is a requirement by the federal government. So when we identify a misapplication, if you will, of advanced premium tax credit, we are required to adjust it and notify the consumer that it's been adjusted. Additionally, customers can choose to further reduce the amount of the tax credit being applied to their monthly premium in order to reduce the chance of having a tax liability come August. So Cover Oregon actually processes income changes over the course of the year. And as a consumer went to enroll in health coverage, again, they use their projected income and are asked that if they have changes in income over the course of the year, that they report that income change to Cover Oregon so that we can appropriately adjust their advanced premium tax credit. This isn't new, unfamiliar work for us. Rather, what we're doing with this particular group of cases, we'll be contacting those consumers to figure out best how they would like us to address this issue. So I'll stop there and see if there are any questions on this issue. I know it's one that's been very important to folks.
You got a net calculation, how much money is involved in this?
Sure. Chair Greenlick, if you, again, first I just need to acknowledge that we still have 8% of these cases that we need to review. But assuming that the error rate holds true for the 92% that we have reviewed, we're looking at a monthly cost of about $9,500. So if you average the, if you multiply out the average months of coverage that people typically have on these plans, it's about 10 months. So the average we're looking at this point in time is just shy of $100,000. However, I'm apprehensive at this point in time to provide a definite dollar figure as we still have that outstanding balance that we're analyzing. Once we do have that information, I'd be happy to provide it back to the committee.
Ask a question.
Go ahead.
At the bottom of the footnote, it says limits range from $300 to $2,500, depending on income. Is that an annual limit?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, it is an annual limit. Those levels are established by the federal government, and they represent the maximum amounts that an individual or family could pay back. So there's a range in there.
$2,500 is the most someone
for a family
could lose in their tax credit.
Correct.
Okay. Go on.
All right. So the next group of slides I'm going to discuss is 2015, and this will get a Representative Greenlick's interest in the budgeting and finances for the coming years for Cover Oregon. Before I get into those details, the most important detail at this point in time, given its proximity to where we are today, is that our 2015 open enrollment period starts November 15th of this year and extends through February 15th of next year. So it's shorter than it was last year, but this is our primary focus right now as Cover Oregon. So the focus on November 15th, 2014, I think Tina did a good job prior to my testimony going through this information, but our overall goal is to ensure that Oregonians can apply, shop, and choose a private plan online, all in one sitting, that those eligible for Medicaid will have a more streamlined process, and that Oregon retains control of the individual and small group marketplaces. Three very important points. I think Tina did a good job of explaining those in her presentation. So for 2015, Oregon will be a supported state-based marketplace. And as Tina and Clyde Hamstreet testified in May, this is a transitional form of marketplace that's acknowledged by the federal government specific to the situation that Oregon finds itself in today. So this new transitional model will allow Oregon to maintain control of its own market for competition, lower cost, better value, et cetera. And the real nuance of this model that we are allowed, that we are going into for 2015, is that the state of Oregon will retain 100% of the assessment dollars generated from the sale of the 2015 individual product. That will provide self-sustaining funding for outreach and education, plan management, call center activities, the shop market, administration, and I have a table in a couple slides that more clearly identifies what will be retained by the state in 2015. And this is that table. So what you have in front of you on this slide is a comparison between the functions of the marketplace in 2014 and what the responsibilities in terms of functions will be of the marketplace in 2015, given the supported state-based marketplace transition. So as you can see, the two most notable differences between 14 and 15 are in eligibility and enrollment functions, the top category, and in appeals, the bottom category. So in 2015, there is no check mark in those columns, as those are specifically federal government responsibilities given our transition to the use of healthcare.gov. All of the other categories remain functions in the state of Oregon that need to be provided to citizens and consumers who will be shopping for insurance products. You'll note that there are a couple asterisks as well. So the big blue asterisks in agent relations and call center represent a shared function between the state of Oregon and the federal government. So as that applies to call center, we are required to maintain a call center here in the state given this new status. However, the federal call center will manage those citizens having difficulties going through the enrollment process using healthcare.gov. So there will be a level of service we provide here to help consumers find community partners, assisters, brokers, get the information they need to know what they need to do in order to purchase insurance, whereas the federal call center will service those people actually going to healthcare.gov and experiencing difficulties or challenges navigating through that process. You'll note that for the second line down under plan management, there's a small green asterisk there. That is only to signify that ultimately the federal government has the final thumbs up in terms of which plans are displayed through healthcare.gov. The function largely remains the function of the state, but the federal government, as it operates healthcare.gov, has the last say in which products are sold through its website. So given that those are the functions that will need to be in the state for 2015, how are we going to fund it all? So the graph that you see in front of you right now is the graph that demonstrates how we are building for self-sufficiency in 2015. And the green line represents the revenue that is being generated from the sale of the 2014 individual product. And this is $9.38 per member per month as it's been applied to the premiums for the products that have been sold in 14. So as of September, Cover Oregon has issued in excess of $4 million of bills to the carriers for the sale of the 2014 products. We will begin collecting on those bills in October, and we anticipate that our year-end revenue from the sale of the 2014 product will be $6.246 million. So you can see that all the way in the upper right-hand corner. So again, this is sale of the 2014 product. This is the plan for self-sufficiency from the get-go, from the onset of the exchange, and it will lead into our finance story for 2015 and 16, which I'll talk about on the next page.
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. So how does the number go up so evenly when there was an open enrollment that ended? Are these change of life? Like, why is it that it kept accumulating additional income?
Sure. So the green line is a steady increase as they're month-to-month enrollment. So there will be a steady increase over time, given that it's nearly the same number month after month after month that is paying the per-member per-month premium into the revenue collection.
People get new jobs and they're eligible even though the open enrollment has ended?
So, Chair Green, like members of the committee, it's a normal monthly fee that continues to come in. So there's a payment that is made for every month over the course of the year.
Okay.
Yeah, my apologies.
What are the two axes?
Excuse me?
What are the two axes?
The left axis is dollars and thousands. Dollars and thousands. So, yes, total dollars. So the blue represents the monthly collection. The green represents the cumulative.
Mm-hmm. And what's the estimated population in this?
I don't know that number, but I can get it back to you to support the table.
Well,
68,000.
It needs to be some specific number, right?
Yeah. So it's not. It will be a function of. So $6.246 million equals the number of months that the premium calculation was made based upon times $9.38.
Or divided by $9, it gives you the number of months.
Yeah.
Correct. I'd be happy to provide the numbers that went into the creation of the table.
Well, let me ask you a different number.
Sure.
What's your membership projection for 2015?
For 2015?
Which is the basis of your income.
So the basis of the income has been built upon, the 101 enrollments that we have based upon the effectuation rate. In terms of the exact number that has led to the $6.246 million, I'd prefer to get the exact number and provide it to you.
That's $6 million for the year?
That's correct. So over the course of 2014, we will have generated $6.246 million based upon the enrollments we have.
That's roughly 80,000. Okay. Right? 80,000, 100,000 months? No. You're estimating your budget for next year is $6 million total.
The next slide actually details the budget a little in a little more depth. So if it's okay, I'd like to move on to that slide, and perhaps it'll answer your question. So 2015 estimated funding. If you look at the first line there, 2014 carryover revenue, that's the $6.246 million from the sale of the 2014 product. Projecting 2000 revenue of $8.694 million based upon 90,000 lives times 10 months times $9.66 per member per month. That'll generate the $8.694 million. Total funding for 2015 would be $14,940,000, and as we're required as an organization to carry a reserve, we will continue to build that reserve. The $2,083,000 represents a 2.5 month reserve, which would leave available funds for 2015 operations of $12.857 million.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So, just so I understand, so the reason this $6.2 million is carried over is our costs for 2014 were covered by the federal government. Is that
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, that's exactly right. So 2014 operations are funded by what we refer to as 1311 grant dollars, mm-hmm. which are the dollars that the federal government have provided to states to start the exchanges.
Okay.
So as many of you know, in 2015, the exchange is required to be self-sustaining. This is our plan to gain that self-sustainability. We will be a very different organization next year, and I have a slide coming up that explains that a little bit.
Thank you.
So, Chair Greenlick, I know you had a question on the prior slide.
I think that's just to me something over 60,000 member months average. I mean, members average over the year?
For 2015. So for 15, it's based on 90,000 lives times 10 months times $9.66, which is the assessment fee for 2015 individual products.
Why 10 months?
It's an average calculation we use for number of months that somebody would have coverage over the course of the year. All right, so before I start talking through this slide, I need to make very clear that this is a pie chart that represents our 2014 spending, 2014. My interest is in providing you with an idea of how the dollars were spent as I start telling the story about how Cover Oregon will be different in the future as an organization. So looking at this pie chart, you can note that on the left, the purple section identifies professional services IT, and at 53% of our budget, Cover Oregon will not be developing, maintaining, operating, owning any technology in 2015. As Tina explained during her presentation, we're transitioning that function, the technology, to the use of healthcare.gov. So that 53% spend will go away for 2015. And this is really the primary difference between what we are today in 2014 and what we will be in 2015. Cover Oregon will be out of the technology business. We'll be largely focused on education and outreach, ensuring that consumers have the resources that they need to make adequate decisions about acquiring high quality affordable health care. Can't believe I just said that. So, in terms of the actual dollars that we're planning for spending in 2015, we've actually started our budget process, which I start talking about on the next slide. Whoops. Okay, so 2015-16 budget planning and timeline. This will be the third year that Cover Oregon has followed this exact budget timeline building process. So between September and November of 2014, the Finance and Audit Committee will review and make recommendation to the board regarding the budget for 2015 and 2016. In December of 2014, the board will adopt the budget for 2015 and 2016 after reviewing that information. And then in January to April of 2015, the Finance and Audit Committee will review and recommend the administrative charge for the 2016 plan year. There will be a public rulemaking process to set that charge, and then the board ultimately will approve the final rule language to set the charge. So my staff right now is going through the process of designing what they feel they will need to run their pieces of the business, given that we will not have the IT for 2015. They're going through that process right now. So as we develop those budgets for each of these departments specific to the functions that we will need to be doing as a state, that will lead into these conversations with the Finance and Audit Committee meeting, the Board of Directors meeting, et cetera.
Are you done?
I am. So I'll take any questions that folks may have at this time.
So based on information you just provided us, so when the projections were put together originally for the assessment, mm-hmm. Funds going forward, that was always based on the fact that the 53% for IT would mm-hmm. substantially be reduced or eliminated once we made the initial investment. Mm-hmm. So it was never projected that the assessment would support an organization that was making substantial investments in IT services.
Sure. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, you're right, but I'd also ask that we recall that the assessment fee was primarily designed to build a reserve for the organization and not to fund the day-to-day operation of the organization. So that being said, we are looking at a dollar figure that initially was meant to cover a few-month reserve for the organization and rather addressing mm-hmm. it as the full operational revenue for the organization moving forward.
Okay, so. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. What you just said about the
sure.
building the reserve versus the operating budget,
mm-hmm.
I did not understand that.
So, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, the assessment fee from the onset of the exchange was always designed to build funding that would support the marketplace should it need to draw on those funds. So a bank account not generating the day-to-day operational funding for the organization.
And where was the operational funding supposed to come from?
A portion of that assessment. But the primary use of that assessment, given the much higher enrollment that was projected for the exchange, would have generated substantially more dollars than we're actually seeing today, given the challenges that
we've
had.
Correct, but it was all, I'm sorry, it's just, you said you made a black and white statement about the assessment not being intended for the operating budget. You mean the level of assessment, the level where it is now? Because it is intended to be the operating budget. It's intended to be the sole source of revenue for
the future,
for Cover Oregon.
So, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, my apologies if I misspoke on that. There was a portion of the assessment dollar, the revenue generated from the assessment fee that would cover operations of Cover Oregon. However, the majority of that assessment was meant to create the reserve for the organization that it could draw upon should it need to from a financial standpoint. The difference between how the exchange was established in the first place and what we will be operating in 2015 under is that we will be using those dollars to primarily fund the operation of the organization and not go into the assessment. So in essence, we have flipped how the revenue generation model will work for the organization moving forward.
Okay.
Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The budget for 2015 is supposed to be largely devoid of IT costs.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I heard Tina say that there was equipment, I assume to be servers, being pulled out of, I think it was Utah and Texas,
mm-hmm.
and I think those are being placed at the state data center.
Mm-hmm.
I believe you will be assessed fees by Department of Administrative Services, and I'm not sure who else, for housing those servers in the state data center.
Mm-hmm.
I would like this committee to know what those fees are going to be and if what the process is for comparing those fees mm-hmm. with what it would cost to house those servers
sure.
in the private sector.
So, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, I think that's a great request. So I would defer it to Tina to explain further as Cover Oregon moving forward will be using healthcare.gov. And our requirement for services will be nominal, given that we will only be using data that pertains to the 2014 plan year, and we will have no need to maintain data moving forward in 2015, as it will all be housed by the federal government.
Paul?
It's a Medicaid expense we're talking about.
Okay, so the state data center will not be charges going forward after that brief and finite period. State data center will not be assessing a fee on this amount of the funding that we should deliver to this program.
So, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, I'm not sure I'm the best person to be in a position to answer that question.
And
so,
personally, I don't.
Fees will be charged to Medicaid, is my assumption. They're only serving Medicaid functions.
I don't need the specific answer, detailed answer to
tomorrow.
The question right now, but I'd like to have it.
Sure. No, I'd be happy to go work with Tina to get you a more comprehensive
answer. Ask that in the committee tomorrow.
Pardon?
You can ask that in the committee tomorrow afternoon.
I could.
You'll have
Actually,
him back.
I could.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I could, and this would probably be for Representative Harker, because I believe he's on the IT.
That's what I said. Yeah, he can do it tomorrow.
Because it doesn't make a lot of sense to pull it out for, like, one short period. I mean, the cost and the expense and the man hours to do that, to me, would be a waste of taxpayer dollars. Why not just leave it there? So
those are for the Medicaid processing system on an ongoing basis rather than for the Cover Oregon. So there will be charges, clearly, but it will be charged to Medicaid rather than the Cover Oregon. But I'd like to ask you another question. How many employees do you have now?
117.
How many do you expect next year?
45 in that ballpark. So given the way that the operation is structured today, we obviously cannot support that spend moving forward. What we will do is be cognizant of the functions that we're required to provide as a state, and I'll work with my team to best figure out how to staff those functions.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I think my question was partly trying to get at that. It looked like the budget for last year was $90 million. You're saying you can save half of that right away because of IT. That would be $45 million. Projected revenue based on the numbers you think will enroll is $12 million. Is that right? So there's a big gap there, and that's why you're going to need to go from 117 to 45 and look at every place where you can cut, I'm assuming. Do I have the big numbers right?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, you do have the big numbers right. So one that I would adjust slightly is our projected revenue for 2000. The total revenue picture for 2015 is $14 million in addition to a $2 million, and then you subtract the $2 million reserve out of there.
Yeah, 12 million.
The plan all along for the marketplace was to be self-sustaining in 2015, and we are continuing with that goal in mind.
But you won't have an operating budget until December. What if the board doesn't approve your operating budget in December? You won't have anybody to lay off at that point.
Chair Greenlake, I don't know how to answer that question at this point in time, but we will continue to work closely with the board, members of this committee, other folks interested in the conversation to ensure that the budget we put together for 15 is appropriate.
You have a plan for a reduction in staff already?
Chair Greenlake, we're working through those details right now. It's part of our budgeting process.
When will you have RIF plans available? This seems to me to be pretty late to be doing some of the things you're talking about doing.
So, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, we're taking into consider all HR policies and practices that are traditionally needed to be in place for a reduction of the size that we're talking about.
Okay.
Can I get
John Conger?
One last question. I don't mean to repeat my prior tirades against Cover Oregon, and certainly you weren't here to have the benefit of them, but most of the people up here were.
You can check the archives.
Yeah, you can check the archives. You get some great stuff.
I've listened to most of them. So.
But the whole point, I was here when we had hearings on creating Cover Oregon, and I was here when we talked about it being self-sustaining, and I was here to cast a vote on the bill that created Cover Oregon. And the whole point was to have a marketplace for where people could shop conveniently and compare prices mm-hmm. for like insurance products. Mm-hmm. And Cover Oregon is no longer effectively providing the marketplace. The federal government is. And so I look at this and I think about the folks who you're serving, who Cover Oregon is serving, and now you as the head of Cover Oregon, I'm not sure that they would think they were getting enough benefit from the list of things that Cover Oregon is going to continue to do to pay the $9+ per month, which for a family of four is almost, it's like $500 a year. A lot of people probably can't afford that, and they'd probably rather have that money. And I don't expect you to answer it, but I just want to point it out again that I'm not sure that Cover Oregon's existence is justified. Forget about the things that have happened in the past and laying blame and all of that. That, I'm sure, will be done over time. But what do we do going forward? I think we should save the $6 million. We should save that for the people who are paying it.
As a final word, thank you very much. As a final word, I must say I agree with what you're saying, and I think we need to be convinced. We need to be convinced as we move forward that there's value added for that money.
That's exactly the point.
That's going to be very much on our mind in December and certainly when we come back.
Well, you want to move on, so.
Yeah, well, we're late, actually.
Yeah, okay.
I'll close the informational hearing. Thank you very much. Good luck in your endeavors, and I'll open up an informational hearing on some issues around OHA, the transformation process, and some others, and we'll try and keep the time compressed. Ms. Hoffman? I've asked them specifically to talk about things on how things are going at at OHA, particularly around the transformation, and to talk particularly around how the 300,000, 300 and some thousand are being integrated into the system, and to deal with the question of the transformation, the extent to which the transformation is really turning into a transformation. So thank you very much. We will keep things down a little bit, but go for it. We're anxiously awaiting.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Suzanne Hoffman. I'm the interim director of the Oregon Health Authority. And with me today is Kathy Kaufman, our director of our Transformation Center. Quick review of what we'll cover today. We'll talk about performance of the coordinated care organizations, or also known as CCOs. Talk about Oregon Health Plan enrollment in 2014 to date. Talk about the Transformation Center and how it's helping to move the system forward, and some other efforts taking place in other parts of the Oregon Health Authority to contribute to health system transformation. So Kathy's going to take the lead at this point.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Kaufman, director of the Oregon Health Authority Transformation Center. So I will very quickly go through the CCO performance metric report. I think the last time this committee heard from OHA, we had not yet released the annual report showing the first year of progress. So we just wanted to make sure everybody got that information. So as a reminder to everyone, we have 33 performance measures statewide. Of those 33 performance measures, 17 are incentive metrics for our CCOs and measured at the CCO level. For this first year, we took our baseline, which was based on 2011 data, and looked at CCO by CCO performance according to their 2013 data. Thanks, Suzanne. So to earn the, and so the, their incentive metrics, because if CCOs meet certain criteria, they are then eligible to draw down bonus dollars based on their performance. So in order to get the full quality pool payment available to them, a CCO had to meet the benchmark or improvement target on at least 12 out of those 17 incentive measures. They also needed to have at least 60% of their members enrolled in a patient-centered primary care home. Any money that's left over from this quality pool from a CCO, say, who didn't reach 100% of the dollars available to earn, went to a challenge pool. And the challenge pool was there to incentivize and reward CCOs who met the benchmark or improvement targets for four challenge pool measures, which were this year depression screening, diabetes blood sugar control, ESPRT, the, I always get this acronym wrong, but substance abuse intervention for referral and treatment, and then PCPCH enrollment in that patient-centered primary care home. So if I can get this to move forward, and instead I'm getting it to move backwards, which is not a good sign, 11 out of our 15 CCOs, 11 out of our 15 CCOs met 100% of the quality pool right there. So we had three hit 80% of the target, and then one of our CCOs hit 70%.
Sorry, say that again. 11 met every
100%.
Met every target?
No, met the criteria that I went through previously, which said you had to meet at least 12 of your 17 targets for incentive measures, and you also had to have 60% of your members enrolled in a patient-centered primary care home. So 11 of our CCOs did that in year one. Three hit 80, one hit 70%. And then because we had three hit 80% and one hit 70%, we had dollars go into a challenge pool. And I'm sorry if we can go forward one more time. You can see what happens after the challenge pool dollars were distributed. That pushed a number of our CCOs over 100% and helped bump up by a little bit the CCOs who were at 80% or 70%. So what's important, so that's really good news. We are happy to see so many of our CCOs making significant progress toward their targets. If you go to the next slide, all CCOs improved on what we feel are pretty critical measures. Number one, ambulatory care, emergency department utilization, reducing the number of members who are seeking care in an emergency room. Improvements on developmental screening for children, improvements on early elective delivery, and improvements on the adoption of electronic health records. We had mixed results on the other measures. Some CCOs opted to really focus on the incentive metrics where they felt like they had the best chance at hitting their target, and that meant other measures lagged. So for this next year, we will be raising the bar. Think of this first year of the quality pool distribution as it's the first test of the school year. And it's great that everybody is doing well in September. It's really promising for how the year is going to go. But the tests are going to get harder and harder. And the A students are going to have harder tests because the better you've done, the harder your next test is going to be. So our metrics And so we'll continue to report at the state and CCO level. We'll be rolling in our 2014 data and monitoring that expansion population that Representative Greenlick was asking about when we started this presentation. And we'll be raising the bar. For 2014, CCOs must show improvement from their 2013 data to receive incentive payments. And the bar will continue to be raised through the transparent process of selecting measures. We have a metrics and scoring committee, which selects the measures for our CCO incentive measures. For 2014, I know the committee is looking at, or for 2015, committee is looking at dropping a couple of measures and adding some others. And for 2014, the incentive pool is increasing. It's going from 2% to 3%. And that's part of the agreement that we have with CMS through our waiver that OHA gets to. The goal is to keep increasing that quality pool so more of the payment is about performance improvement as opposed to continuing to just pay for episodes of care. So that's a really quick hit on the performance measures. We have a more detailed report. You can delve in CCO by CCO. We'd be happy to get that out to the committee. But with that, unless there are any specific questions, I can hand it back over to Susan.
I have a question. Let's see if anybody else has a brief question. Yes. Who we got?
Representative Widener.
Representative Widener. I didn't know whether your hand was up or not.
Just real quick, you said that they're going to get harder in the objectives for the ones that are performing well. Why wouldn't it get harder for the ones that aren't performing well? Because the guys that are already doing the job, why would we make it tougher for them versus the CCOs that aren't doing the job? So it seems backwards.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Representative Widener, it's a great question. So keep in mind this answer will be coming from, you know, my limited understanding of how the setup of the incentive metrics was approached. So the benchmarks are all based on national benchmarks. This is really for if we're looking at making our Medicaid program best of class, this is where we should be in all of these different performance measures. The reason why it gets harder and harder for CCOs who perform better and better is because, you know, the beginning improvements are usually the easiest improvements. You know, we know that for some of our measures, the improvements that we saw were really about better data collection as opposed to changes in how care was provided. So the first step is the easiest step. The farther down the road you go in transformation, the harder and harder it's going to be. It also means that for the CCOs who don't show significant improvements, they'll be losing out on more and more of the quality pool.
I think the other issue is the benchmarks are embarrassingly low. When you read through those data, I wouldn't want to go to any plan that had the kind of benchmarks that those plans had. And I think, and the fact that we gave away all the incentive money, in spite of the fact that five plans didn't meet 12 of the, I mean, didn't meet five, only met five of the 17. I think there's a long way to go in this system. We'll be back to that another day. We're way behind, but do you have a
question? I just wondered if I know some of the incentives that were not adopted early on were like tobacco use. I know one key question has been, you know, very much part of your conversations. I'm wondering where those stands, or are you going to report back in December about which ones are now being adopted as you move forward?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Representative Kenny Geyer. So, again, the Metrics and Scoring Committee, which has been created through legislation, is the body accountable for determining which incentive measures are in and which are out. So when that committee has made decisions, of course, we will come back to you all and make sure
we'll have some time in December. It's something we really need to explore, because I think we have a ways to go with that. Please go on, Ms. Hoffman.
So just to bring you up to date on enrollment numbers, as of September 1st, 2014, 993,800 Oregonians are on the Oregon Health Plan. That represents an increase of 380,600 who have received coverage since January 1, 2014. And other good news is that nearly 90% of those Oregon Health Plan members are in coordinated care organizations. These numbers are significant, obviously, much more than may have been anticipated in the first few months and throughout 2014. We had extensive outreach and education efforts that account for so many people being able to get the coverage they need in such a short period of time. The Oregon Health Authority has an outreach team, and that team, in partnership with Cover Oregon, trained more than 2,300 individuals statewide, resulting in more than 1,350 active assisters in 330 different organizations. They managed 49 grants, 41 volunteer agreements, and hundreds of OHA contracted providers are also certified to provide application assistance. We don't have definite numbers on exactly how many people received assistance to get their coverage, but we do have enough information to tell us that tens of thousands of people received direct assistance, either to apply online or through a paper process. The Oregon Health Authority has been working in partnership on these efforts with Cover Oregon for some time, ever since the system did not work as originally planned. I think that we've done so, our staff have done so under the label of Cover Oregon in the spirit of all being one and to help minimize confusion for people seeking coverage. But I would be remiss if I didn't call out the fact that it was a lot of Oregon Health Authority staff who contributed to that effort, who manned a call center, who stood up a temporary call center of temporary staff in order to help people get enrolled. It was a very challenging time, and I think our staff rose to the occasion. I want to acknowledge them for that. And as we move forward into the re-enrollments that need to occur for the Oregon Health Plan, we have learned a lot from having stood up that hybrid temporary process. We'll apply those lessons learned going forward to be able to re-enroll people smoothly. And, of course, as Tina discussed in her presentation, a lot of those re-enrollments will occur through the federal site for this first.
Re-enroll.
For the re-enroll, yes, for the next year.
Re-enroll Medicaid.
Yes, as Tina described, there'll be a landing page where people can go to determine the best place for them to enroll. And
don't need to re-enroll Medicaid.
Redeterminations is probably
redeterminations,
the word.
Okay.
Re-enrollment maybe sounds a little more customer.
It's very different than redetermination.
Yeah, but it's what you would understand to be the redetermination process for a Medicaid applicant, yes. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Kathy to talk about the Transformation Center and its role in helping coordinated care organizations to serve people well.
So as a reminder, the Transformation Center was created using a grant award that we received from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Innovation, our state innovation model grant award. The Transformation Center houses the innovator agents assigned to each CCO and then also seeks to just support the spread of transformation and the good work happening in communities in our CCOs. We say that, you know, we are not the experts in transformation. We're not here to tell CCOs how to do it. They and their communities are the experts. We're simply here to help the good ideas travel faster and to connect what's happening well in one CCO to the other CCO so we can all learn from each other. So learning collaboratives have been underway in that effort. We have a collaborative of all of the medical directors and many of the behavioral health directors of each of the CCOs. They meet in person on a monthly basis and also have interaction in between meetings through an online forum. They've elected to focus on the incentive metrics as the topic for their learning collaboratives. Those meetings, those meetings started off as being a forum in which the medical directors all got together, and the focus was pretty operational and, you know, a very bureaucratic kind of meeting. And I'm happy and surprised to see that a year later, the meetings for the learning collaborative part have really developed into meaningful conversations among the medical directors where they are sharing what they're doing, they're sharing the challenges that they each face, they are seeking outside expertise to come to those meetings and help them think through some of the work that they're trying to do, and also really connecting the dots. I think one of the concerns we've heard about the incentive metrics is, well, but they're not really, you're not really measuring transformation. You're measuring some basics about delivering primary care. And in the conversations amongst the medical directors, it's become really clear that they're taking those primary care measures and using them as a jumping off point. For example, in talking about the adolescent screenings and, you know, why aren't we doing better when it comes to adolescent screenings? The conversation quickly shifted from just being about doing the screening to hit your target and talking about how that opportunity, when you do an adolescent screening, is an opportunity to maybe prevent teen pregnancy or substance abuse or catch behavioral health needs, that it really is more than just checking the box and doing the screening. So we're really pleased about how the medical directors have really shown leadership and willingness to collaborate together. We've also been convening a collaborative for the Community Advisory Council members. You all know that each CCO is required to have a Community Advisory Council, and that Community Advisory Council is meant to be 50% consumer. And of course, it's one thing to have a Community Advisory Council with a bunch of consumers on it, and it's another thing to have that be a really meaningful and effective committee that is able to engage and work with and support the CCO and reflect the needs of the community. The CACs are all being used differently by their CCOs. They all have different strengths and challenges. They are all incredibly eager to connect with each other. That's probably been the most fun part of any of the work in the Transformation Center, is to see how excited they are to be contributing to the improvement of the Oregon Health Plan, how eager they are to really talk with each other and hear about how one CAC is doing something and how they can learn from each other. So we've brought them together with some generous support from the Northwest Health Foundation for in-person meetings. We've been able to pay for their travel and lodging so that we can bring consumers together in the same space. So we continue to just focus on that work, focus on creating a space for the CAC members to come together, bringing in any outside TA or learning that they ask us for, and then are also looking to see how we can support them and bring them together around the community health improvement plans, which have now all come in from the CCOs. And there are lots of areas of overlap, so we're excited about that. Lastly, there's been a collaborative focused on providers who are serving the complex care population. We also refer to them as our high-risk, high-utilizer population. So each CCO, each community has a different clinic or a different approach to providing care to that population. We've brought these providers together to really talk about their different models of care and to share and learn from each other. And that's also been really exciting because it's fun to get out of the wonk of policy and systems and get down to the provider level and support folks who are really doing good work out there. We've also launched a Council of Clinical Innovators, developing some leadership at the provider level to help be champions of change for transformation, work to support transformation of OHA internally, continue to refine how we do operations to better support our CCOs and our new way of doing business, and also are seeking to support any of the CCOs that are ready to partner with their new early learning hubs. We have one CCO, our Yamhill CCO, which is the CCO as well as the hub. That's about as integrated as you can get. We have other CCOs who really see the value in partnering very quickly with their hubs, and so we're just seeking to support them and bring them together in whatever way will be most helpful to them.
I need to ask you to wrap up.
Lastly, Transformation Fund dollars are out. We have information up on our website, transformationcenter.org, how all of those funds are being used. They're covering a wide array of projects in each CCO, and we'll be bringing everyone together in December at our annual Coordinated Care Model Summit to share exactly what's going on in each CCO with their transformation funds. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Maybe one or two brief questions. Good. We're going to get you back because the heart of the issue of the CCO is just to figure out how to transform the delivery of services. And so you're very central to what we're interested in, and we'll keep in touch.
Okay.
I think you've also invited some of us to the summit, which would be, if anybody can make it, would be. It's my intention to be there. I'm very interested.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much. Closing informational hearing on OHA, CCO, as other letters, and open up a hearing on the health insurance rate review, and ask Ms. Calley to come and briefly share with us how it went this time. I think it was a little different than it has been in the past, and I see you waiting.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and I will do my best to be brief. I don't have slides, so hopefully I can get through things pretty quickly and still give you some good information. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Calley. I'm the insurance commissioner with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'll just give you kind of a brief recap of what rate review is, how things went this time around, and try to be brief so you can ask questions if you have them. So I think, generally speaking, our rate review process was approached in a very similar way to how we approached it in 2014. But we continued to really have a large body of work in front of us. And so just as a way of a recap, we have a very condensed time period in which to do our rate review. And it's basically what amounts to a thorough kind of peer review actuary in our shop, reviewing the actuarial work from the insurance companies who sell their plans in the commercial market. It applies to the individual market and the small group market. Those are the two areas where we have rate authority. And we have about 2 months to go through our process in reviewing and making sure that the rates are justified and that they're reasonable, that they're not too high and also not too low. And that process is really very condensed when you think that we had 41 filings to review during that period, and we open a public comment period that stretches through just a shade over 30 or 40 days, and we look at the comments that we get from the public. We involve Osberg as a representative of the public with a bit more technical expertise, and then we have correspondence back and forth with the actuaries that work for the insurance companies, and also go through a public hearing that we air to the web for every single filing. So that all of that was very similar to what we've done in the past. I think the unique challenge for us this time around is that we had 41 filings, and that included the plans that comply with the new reforms under the ACA. There were also a couple of carriers that are offering what we call transitional plans, so plans that don't meet all the requirements under the reform but were able to continue right now until the end of 2015. We have a handful of carriers that are offering those. So that led to quite a bit of work. I'd say, generally speaking, we had a very successful review. Competition was a huge driver of the rates that were filed with us. We saw that carriers who had been kind of on the higher end of the rate spectrum in 2014 came in and sought to reduce their rates. And then those that had been on the lower end of things sought to increase their rates by a little bit. And when we look at the carriers that had the lowest rate proposals for 2015, I believe it was the five carriers in the individual market with the lowest rates. We actually approved rates that were slightly higher than what they had requested. And then for the remaining carriers, which in the individual market I think was eight carriers, we actually reduced their rates so that we approved something lower than what they asked for. And I think that the important thing to remember is that our role is to make sure that rates are adequate. It's all in really in the vein of protecting the consumer. And so we want to, of course, make sure that the rates aren't too high, that consumers aren't being gouged. But on the flip side, the rates need to be sustainable. It's not in the best interest of consumers to take the rates way down, gain market share, and then be in a situation where there either needs to be a huge rate increase the next year or the insurer has difficulty paying claims. And so it's really important to kind of hit that nice sweet spot that's really in the range of reasonability. So that was the approach that we took to all of our rate decisions. And in the end, we announced our decisions in early August. And one of the things I think that many of you heard about is that we had at least some discussion of carriers who may not have completely agreed with the decision that we made. And so there's been some discussion about whether there's actually an appropriate or reasonable window to have that kind of back and forth, that we'd propose a decision and whether there's any opportunity to discuss the basis of that and make sure that we can come to agreement on whether it's been justified. And so that's something that we're looking at right now. We're meeting with stakeholders to better understand how we might be able to improve that process so that we continue to have a very public and very transparent way of expressing and investigating the findings in our filings, and that we come to a result that really is fair and is that it represents kind of a very even level playing field across the market. So that's something that we are going to be looking at in the next several weeks, talking with both insurance companies but also with consumers that are paying a lot of attention to this. So that's pretty much really what I have on the process, but I'm happy to go into any other details if you have questions. Thank you.
I have a quick question, and maybe just asking this will help illustrate how you do this.
Sure.
In the standard silver plan, the highest one is the highest one is $299, and yet in the standard gold plan, another carrier offers that for $280. Mm-hmm. So how is it that somebody in silver that has to do a certain number of services to qualify for silver versus gold can offer have a rate that is higher than someone in the gold at a lower?
Chair Green, like Representative Kinney-Geyer. So that is an interesting thing that happens sometimes when you're looking at projections of future claims. So there's no right answer that either we or the carriers all have at this point. It's all based on estimates of how we think the claims will turn out for 2015. And so what that does is it does create a range of reasonable answers. And certainly if we had the same carrier proposing a lower rate for silver than gold, I think that would be a serious cause for concern. We likely wouldn't approve that. Pardon me?
Lower rate for gold than silver.
Did I say it backwards? Yes, lower rate for gold than silver.
Basically because they have different populations.
And they actually shouldn't be reflecting differences in their risk pool, because the whole concept as we move into the post-reform world is that really everyone is going to have the average risk. So you still may have differences in terms of the provider contracts and how that affects the rates that they reimburse their providers. There may be differences. Smaller carriers have to spread administrative costs over a lower smaller population. You might have different construction of the actual networks that provide the services. It may not just be about the benefits. So some carriers may have broader networks that offer really more options, and that means actually less control over costs for the carrier. So there can be a number of reasons why there's differences, but I think over time we'll expect to see some leveling out and some convergence of the rates across the market.
You also have different assumptions built in, and I wonder if you could get me a list of the medical trend assumptions that went in. I still have a feeling that you ought to pick out medical trend and give it to them. But it would be very interesting to see the range, if you will, of the medical trends that went into the assumptions.
Chair Green, like, I can get you a range of what we approved, and I will say that while we didn't pick a trend and say that this trend is what everyone in the market will price to, we did say that there was a reasonable range of trend, and there were a couple of carriers who had priced either higher than that range or below that range, and our decision reflected an adjustment to bring it within the range we thought was reasonable.
Still feels to me it would be better to do that in advance to have some consistency. I mean, under the assumption everybody's entitled to their own opinion but not their own facts, it would be really good if we started with an agreement on the facts going in. There you go. Well, your first question.
Well, it's more of a comment than a question.
Keep it brief.
Okay. He's usually more accommodating than that.
Maybe
so.
What we could do is have...
This is part of the freshman hazing, though.
Maybe the insurance commissioner could come back and explain the rate-setting process, because I've heard concerns from people, too, about how did they decide what, you know, who should be lower and who should be higher. And it'd be interesting to me to have that revealed and explained. Not today, obviously.
I think that's a great suggestion, and I think the more we learn about the process, we hope the more comfortable we'll be with knowing what's going on. So perhaps we can reslot that for December and have a little more sort of here's how
rate
it went.
Rate review 101.
Yeah.
Chair Greenlink, Representative Nose, I would be happy to do that. And if I could just make one quick plug, too. I gave you just a sampling of some of the consumer tools that we have on our website. And some of you may be more familiar with what's on our website than others. But it's an area where we're really trying to make an effort there to get information that's user-friendly. And so we have a table just like that for all 7 geographic rating areas in the state. And we have examples for the individual market at age 21, 40, and 60. And you may or may not recall that there's an age band that basically limits the variation in rates from age 21 all the way up to age 65 to no more than a difference of 3-1. So we kind of give you the whole gamut. We've got individual and small group up on our website, and we also have some consumer-friendly decision summaries that explain how we made each of our decisions.
If you could also get Representative Noss a copy of the most recent health insurance report, that's a very useful report. I think you'll find it fast. No, it's really fascinating.
Okay.
Because it goes into information that's very useful.
I would love that too. I would be happy. I can share the latest version. It's a little outdated. We took a year off as the earth shifted a little bit, and we're actually working right now on preparing the report that will tell you about what happened in 2014. But I can get the 2012 report out to you all. I think it's still really helpful in understanding kind of the landscape and industry. So
I mean, it deals with reserves and a whole sort of things that are very interesting. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure. I'll see you.
Felt like
in
you
December.
Did a pretty good job.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Greenlink.
Yeah. Close the informational hearing on the rate review. And open an informational hearing on the program Bridges to Health Initiative, Columbia Gorge Health Council, brought to us by Representative Conger. And we have Coco Yackley, please. Is that right?
You did fabulous.
Should be an easy name to get.
Yeah, you can just call me Coco, and that's fine, too.
All right. It's a deal.
Great. Thank you. And will this?
Yes.
Okay. Excellent. For the record, my name is Coco Yackley. I'm the operations consultant for the Columbia Gorge Health Council, which is the governance arm for the Columbia Gorge CCO. I appreciate the time to be able to have a few minutes to talk about what's happening out in the field, as we say, and tie in a little bit of some of the stuff that Kathy Coffin was just talking about a few minutes ago. We will be spending a little time just talking about our community advisory council and what we've been able to do there to engage our local consumer members, the projects and programs that they have initiated in our region, as well as talk a little bit about Bridges to Health. Our model in the Gorge looks like this. Pacific Source is known as the CCO of record, and we have the Columbia Gorge Health Council as our local governance group. Consists of 12 board members from the two counties, which include Hood River and Wasco County. We're a small community. And with that, we have a community advisory council, like as mandated in the legislature. We have over 50% consumer members engaged in that group. We also have a clinical advisory panel consisting of 17 practicing providers in the region. So we have those two structures in place and operating right now. Mm-hmm. Today, I'd like to spend and zero in a little bit on our community advisory council in particular. We are a small region. Out in the Gorge area, people cross the river. They go to that other state. They go to the other counties. You know, so it isn't as hardcore as staying just within Hood River and Wasco counties. People do float around a little bit more. And so it became important for us as we stood up this community advisory council that it could act as a consumer voice to more than just CCO business. So if there's a nonprofit, a healthcare concern, a hospital that wanted to make a policy or practice change that was going to have a big impact on consumers in our area, we wanted to know they had a venue to go there and not have to create yet a separate body to do that. And so our ability to really grow this Community Advisory Council to be more than just CCO matters has been extremely successful. And it's really helped to build and establish that group as the go-to place for a variety of things, predominantly right now CCO business, but expanding well beyond that scope. We've already finished our community health assessment, and as part of that activity, we were able to get 11 organizations to all come together for one community health assessment, as well as a community health improvement plan. In addition, I understand we're a little unique. We actually gave $150,000 of our transformation funds for the CAC to decide on what they wanted to do with it. And what was the best ideas they came forward, including a lot of investment in community health worker training centers, peer support, emotional literacy training, which is really targeted at 0 to 5 and people that work with 0 to 5 age group, and bridges to health, which I'll spend a little bit more time talking about. In addition, one of the Community Advisory Council members was so excited about this, she went over to the Clinical Advisory Panel and convinced them to use some of their money to invest in another project that I'll talk about as well, which has to do with connecting up Meals on Wheels with people coming out of the hospital. So our Community Advisory Council has been really quite busy and quite active. We have 8 voting members today, and you can see in the list in blue the various perspectives they bring to the table, whether it's parents of children with disabilities, to foster parents, to themselves disabled, age groups included. In addition, we've brought together a lot of the social service and nonprofits. There's a lot more of those folks at the table. We limit them to 7 voting seats. But we do have a much broader participation, and that includes not only the foundations from the hospitals, but nonprofit organizations, DHS, Agency on Aging. We have the fire departments, which in our region end up being first responders. So it's quite a broad perspective of people that attend our Community Advisory Council, and that's a list of several of the organizations that are part of it, including representatives from the Washington side. And what we have found in our journey as we've been talking about healthcare transformation is that's not just about healthcare organizations. Now, this may seem intuitively obvious to people until you start digging into it. And we have found that really to talk about transformation, you've got to bring social services to the table, because guess what? Social services tend to know where and who the people are that need help. Healthcare is great at treatment, but they're kind of not so great at finding people who need treatment. Social services are an excellent arm for being able to find those that are in need. Schools are also another venue. Nonprofits, a great venue. Transportation, I pull in particular, because with non-emergency medical transportation as a benefit, figuring out how you get people to appointments is a key aspect of that. And then obviously consumers themselves. Guess what? They know people besides themselves who are in need. Transformation has to include all of these components. It can't be just a healthcare. And the reason why I'm pausing on this piece is when we talk about engaging in transformation, we got to be able to share information across just healthcare entities. We need to be able to have shared measures, shared goals, and have accountability that extends well past healthcare. I could go on and on about any of the 17 metrics. I won't, but if you look at who's at the table, you need to have representatives from all of these boxes and be able to hold all of them equally accountable and have transparency in each of these organizations. And so it's touching well past healthcare on this side. So let's talk about a couple of the programs, which I think are a little bit different. One is Meals on Wheels. Our Community Advisory Council member, she just said, you know, I work at Meals on Wheels, and I hear about people that need food, and we've got people coming out of the hospital, and maybe they're in a vulnerable state. They don't have family nearby. What does the hospital do? Maybe the hospital puts them in some temporary care situation at hundreds of dollars a day. So we've been able to partner up one of our hospitals in the Meals on Wheels program to be able to deliver. Think of food as a prescription. Someone's coming out of the hospital. Do they need a specific kind of dietary need? Meals on Wheels can deliver 2 meals a day at less than $20 a day. Wow, that's an extremely affordable price point. Not to mention, they're delivering food in somebody's home. So they're going in and visiting somebody, having a brief chat. Are they okay? If they see something that isn't okay, they know who to call back. And they can just, you know, feedback any information that they need to back to the hospital discharge as needed or the primary care. So we've been able to take a social service organization, traditionally not tied to healthcare in any way, and pull them in through use of transformation funds. Talk about an affordable way to address a very real need in a community. And this has been a great program. We're extending it a little bit further to allow Pacific Source to be able to identify candidates through claims data and not be limited to a very busy physician at discharge time. So that's one of the programs that, by listening to consumers, they can come forward with some pretty powerful examples. The next one having to do with Bridges to Health. In middle of last year, we were designated as an Oregon Solutions designation from Governor Kitzhaber around this idea of how do you take disparate nonprofit and community outreach programs and connect them together through a hub model that would allow you to more be able to integrate a lot more effectively in the community. And we brought together 23 different organizations across the community to form up and outline what we call Bridges to Health. And what Bridges to Health is the idea that you have so many social service and nonprofit agencies already in the community. They're going to find people who have needs. How do you create an ecosystem that lets them connect it to the right treatment? You have a standard way of measuring things, and when you have successful outcomes, you have a means for directing payment for outcomes back to those agencies. So if we take one example, which is developmental screenings, it's a simple one that we have within the CCO. It's one of our metrics. Kids 0 to 3, based on age, developmental screening. DHS sometimes knows those kids. Head Start actually knows a lot of the kids. daycare, preschools, even the health departments encounter many of these children as part of their day-to-day jobs. If they find that they conduct that developmental screening, then connecting it into primary care venues where the primary cares are having constructive conversations with parents. We know that we've succeeded or failed through a quality metric score. And then based on that outcomes, you have a means for providing payments back to agencies. So rather than a model that says, we'll give you X amount of dollars and we hope you'll be able to accomplish so many developmental screenings or so many breast exam outreach or fill in the blank on any kind of program along that line, to changing it to a model of we will pay you when this outcome happens. And the dollar amount of that outcome can vary based on complexity. Whether it's a developmental screening, could be a dollar amount that's, say, $50. A baby with a healthy birth weight might be worth a heck of a lot more money. helping people go through their redetermination process for enrollment in healthcare, the redetermination process with Medicaid so we don't have people coming off, that might be worth a different kind of money. And who that's worth will change based on what the measure is you're looking for, what kind of outcome you're looking for, and how complex it is. So our Bridges to Health model is around creating this ecosystem that has a hub, a way of defining what success looks like, and a payment structure back to the agencies, whether they're social service agencies, they could be potentially government agencies, wouldn't that be novel? Could be healthcare agencies. It could be community members that participate in helping to solve these problems. So that's our overall program around Bridges to Health. In looking at our challenges as we go forward in the local region, group grading is always an interesting. Everybody gets a little uncomfortable in their seats when they talk about group. So how do you take incentive monies that are coming back at the aggregate level and distribute them back out in the community? Is it based on individual performance, group performance? Those are the kinds of things. We'll sort that out in the community. There's nothing new about that. But the government agency restrictions on being able to, what I think of as act like businesses, has been kind of problematic in a couple of areas. If we look at certain areas of the business, like transportation, that has traditionally been in a government agency kind of structure, being able to take risk or being able to take incentive payments or anything along that line makes it very awkward for being able to integrate with other organizations who must take risk and also may or may not be eligible for incentive payments. Same thing with DHS. Wouldn't it be interesting if we could figure out a way for incentive payments to flow back to DHS, to feel like they're part of the same, what success looks like, transparency, those sorts of things. So it does create some interesting borders or dynamics when you have parts of your local ecosystem that can't operate in the same ways as other parts of the ecosystem. I'm not advocating that we don't have needs for public sector, but it seems like a hybrid ought to be possible. Immigration for us is a big deal in Hood River County. We still have quite a few individuals in our community that are uninsurable at this stage, so depending on how that falls out, we'll have a ripple effect in our community. And then I cannot emphasize the greatness that we've experienced so far with our Consumer Advisory Council, but we have to continue to focus on user-centered design principles from the get-go. You know, not just asking them after the fact, what do they think? And not just testing ideas when they're in their, you know, oh, well, let's test it out. But how about actually source of ideas? Tell us what, you know, why not be potentially in the design team from the get-go? And really figuring out how you do that consistently, broadly, and repeatedly in the community is something that we, you know, we're committed to doing. Figuring out how to do that over and over again is a little bit harder to do. So I realize that was a very rapid
You did a great job. Through,
but I know you guys you were right on time. To get back on time.
You did a great job. We have time for a brief question or two.
I will gladly come back to anybody for any other detail.
I'd love to go offline with you and talk more, because you've mentioned a lot of early childhood things, which really warms my heart, and nonprofit connections, which also warms my heart. And I'm curious about how you're overlapping, you know, how your geographic boundaries and the early learning hub in your area overlap. I'd love to talk with you more. It's a way bigger issue.
Yeah, I will gladly take any of that offline with you, no issues, or anybody else, no issues whatsoever.
It's also a beautiful place to visit. Representative Lively?
Sure, I just had a quick question about the bridges to help that theory. So this, the payment for outcomes, it appears to me there might be some changes the organization would have to make up front in order to be able to reach the outcomes that you're going to pay for.
Right.
So is there any incentive for them other than the fact they're going to get paid later for the outcome?
Oh, in terms of that transition, like how do we go from today, which is you get the money up. We are in the case of developmental screenings, no organization gets paid today, so that's an easy one to go pilot on.
Sure.
And figure out what that, and what is the price point, and what would motivate change. And we're also working with PCORI, who's a research institute, to help us put, you know, we're saying, is there any opportunities here to look from the science-y research side of where are those cross points, and what would be motivating, because that's interesting science, in addition to actually getting the job done.
Thank you.
Jason.
Okay, thank you very much.
No, I just want to say...
Yeah, well, thank you for organizing this.
Yeah, may I introduce Coco as... become a good friend, but has been around since the formation of the Health Council and is now the operations manager. She has a background at Intel. She doesn't tell anyone about that. I don't know why, but has really added a lot of discipline and organizational structure to what is, I think, the second smallest or third smallest CCO in the state, measured by membership and budget. And Pacific Source, by the way, is the CCO. The Health Council is a nonprofit that was formed specifically to provide the governance structure for the CCO and to do things like engage consumers in the CAC, in the Consumer Community Advisory Council, and make sure that that element was there. And the amazing thing is, after the 2013 session, I think it was, where there was a lot of feedback that that the CCOs had no consumer element, that they weren't connected to the community. Well, the Gorge is an example of what can happen when they actively try to engage consumers, and they actually bring them into designing the programs to figure out how to transform healthcare and the benefit that comes to the CCO from that, but also the success in engaging the community. And here this is really one of the smallest of the state CCOs. It's an odd mixture. It has two hospitals and two counties. One is very sparsely populated. The other is semi-sparsely populated. It's just a great success story. And here they are doing what I think is implementing the big vision, the policy vision of healthcare transformation on the ground and connecting the dots in a way that I just thought the committee should really hear about. A couple of examples of. Those are only examples. There's more.
Yeah, I think we need to sort of have an example with us every session to be a
feel-good story.
Well, no, it's not feel-good. It's success, right?
No, yeah.
Not just
yeah,
the
I think
the
we would
failures.
Not characterize anymore that there's no connection to the communities. I think more and more the CACs are becoming involved, even in places where it's a surprise.
We've been working with Kathy Kaufman to go to the CAC councils that she's pulling together to help explain some of the things that we've trying to do, what's worked, what's not, and that sort of thing. So with that, I will leave you guys to get back on schedule.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you.
We ought to look in on Yamhill County, yeah.
Yeah.
Because we hear good things coming from Yamhill County, yes. Too. That would be a good example.
I told Coco that, as a matter of fact, yeah. After the hearing.
Silas.
Give Silas a call.
I closed the public hearing and open a public hearing on the state of palliative care. We have Woody, will you join us? Eddie Goldberg, will that be? Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Thank you very much. And thank you for offering us time with you this afternoon. I'm Woody English, and I'm a recently retired physician. I was medical director for palliative care for Providence in the state of Oregon before my retirement, and now I'm working in the community. My co-presenter is Adie Goldberg from Medford. Adie has a story to tell. And the reason we wanted to talk with you is because of the partnership that we have in promoting good end-of-life care in Oregon. And that's something that we as a state and citizens of the state, I think, are very proud. But with any good idea, sometimes there are unexpected outcomes and occasionally unintended consequences. And therefore, as we track what we do, I think it's important to talk a little bit from the field and from actually where the people and process issues are going, what's working and what's not working. So this is an opportunity to just talk with you a little bit about that. Much of the work of addressing good end-of-life care through the Pulse Form, which you all helped create for us, which is wonderful, and the Advanced Directive, which you also helped to create for us, is done outside of healthcare organizations and in the community. And it's a lot of this community outreach for people who at that time are not so seriously ill that they are about to die or need a Pulse Form, that much of our work is now moving as we have become successful with the Pulse Form. So, Adie, do you want to talk a little bit about your work? Adie works with a community organization, and that's what's really important about our presentation today and her message.
Well, thank you for having me as well. I get to today wear three hats. I don't normally get to wear all three hats at once.
Please introduce yourself.
Adie Goldberg. And I'm going to say what I do because I have three different hats. One of the hats that I wear is that I am the palliative care social worker at Rogue Regional Medical Center in Medford. The second hat that I get to wear all the time, even when I'm not doing it, is that I'm a doctoral student finishing up her dissertation in the continuum of care for the seriously ill. And then the third hat, which is what I'm going to talk to you about, is that I am the co-chairperson of COHO, which is Choosing Options, Honoring Options. It's a grassroots organization that began about 4.5 years ago in Medford when the credentialing committee came to the hospital and we found that we did not, in fact, have the requisite number of Pulse on file to be credentialed. So rather than begin with technology, which is often associated with this point of our life, I'm actually just going to tell you a story. But before I do that, I want to clarify is that when I come into a room and introduce myself as the palliative care social worker, people often think I'm hospice. So I just want to clarify for everyone, when we talk about state of palliative care, we're talking about a bigger picture, which is not hospice. Hospice is that final 6 to 12 months of life when the physician would be surprised that a patient would still be alive. And it's at those moments that a POLST really is appropriate for that person. Most of us are not at that point in our life story, but that doesn't mean we don't have preferences about if that happened to us, what those preferences and what we would like to look at.
Can you just clarify POLST?
POLST.
Physician
order for the, it's that thing that looks like Pepto-Bismol colored. It is the three question physician orders for life-sustaining treatment, and it basically has three questions, which is, do you want to be resuscitated? Do you want to have maximum care, limited care, or comfort measures only? And would you like artificial nutrition for a prolonged period of time, trial period of time, or none at all? It is signed by a physician, and it goes into a state registry, which we as the state of Oregon are the national leader for. We are the story that every state looks to. When I go to national conferences, they always talk about Oregon's program. But I'm going to tell you a different story, and every time I do a presentation, I'm aware that everyone has a story, either a loved one, a parent, a friend, where end-of-life concerns come up on the table. So the story I'm going to tell you is about Robert and Laura. And Robert moved to Oregon about 4 months ago from California with his wife, Laura. It was a late-in-life marriage for them, and Robert wanted to be closer to his children so that they would get to know Laura. And 70 years old, healthy, had no health issues at all, absolutely was inappropriate for having a POLST because there's no reason, no one anticipated.
Do we have a confidentiality issue here?
No.
You have permission to use his name?
This is an amalgamation story.
Okay, it's not an actual person.
Not an actual story.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very, very aware. I forgot where I was. So he came to Oregon to have his children meet and get to know his wife. He had talked with her about his end-of-life preferences, and what he said was that he did not want extraordinary measures. While carrying in the boxes into the house, he had a heart attack, and he had to have a resuscitation in the field by the EMTs. He was non-responsive when he was brought to the hospital. And his wife, Laura, really did want to honor the conversation. She couldn't find the advance directive, however, in the midst of the move. The children all came, and they wanted more time with Dad. And then the discussion became more heated about what was in Robert's best interests. And so that's really where I'm coming to you today. I'm asking for help. We have the POLST. It is simple. A physician orders it. What we currently have is a document that's difficult to fill out for people who are not medically literate or literate, period. The language is complicated, the concepts are complicated, and frequently the opportunity to fill one out does not come until you're in crisis when your best functioning is not to the fore. And so it's with this that I come to you to ask for the state to consider that we look at making the conversation bigger than just the POLST so that we can address a larger swath of people who need to have this conversation and have it documented. Perhaps it's a statewide registry, an e-advance directive, a document that's easier to understand. Because what I really would like to consider is that Oregon becomes the national model for a conversation zone, not just for the last 6 to 12 months of life, but for the whole lifespan, so that end-of-life care, when it comes to that moment, focuses on the care and not on moving through and sorting through moving boxes and file cabinets.
So our opportunity here is honestly to forge a partnership with you, since both the POLST form and the current advanced directive are authorized in Oregon through statute and defined by the ORS. The Pulse form, just to give you an update, now has about 110,000 active citizen in their files. It's working very successfully, and we're proud of it, and we've been the national leader, and most of the other states of the country either have something similar or are working towards something similar, and there is thought now in a number of parts of the United States that the kind of registry we have here may eventually become, in fact, a national model and a national registry. And there are people developing software to be able to do that. And OHSU is trialing the software this fall, so it's more than vaporware at the moment. On the other hand, most of the conversation is, as Adi pointed out, is for people who aren't at that stage in their life. But we start the conversation and language with them. And when we do that, they want to do something, take some action, complete a form. And so we're working towards coming up with an advanced directive conceptually that may nest within the Pulse and be appropriate for that, in which case, since this has a statutory foundation, to let you know that we're working towards that. We don't want anything happening right now. In fact, as I sat down here and recognized that next year is 2015, sort of serendipitously, the first Pulse Task Force met next year, 25 years ago, in 1990, and the Pulse itself became statewide in 1995. So next year will be the 20th anniversary of the Pulse going statewide. So maybe it makes sense for us to work towards this so we can push basically our leadership, both for our community and nationally, to the next level and address this loophole.
We're also at the 20th anniversary of Death with Dignity.
Yes, we are.
And there are some of us are interested in rethinking some of that as well. So this might be a good time to take all those things into consideration.
So that's any questions you have is fine with us. So.
Okay.
Can I just say one thing? The Anatomical Donors Organization has come to me with some ideas about how to get more people to be thinking about that, and there just seems like there could be some good synergies there. So
absolutely,
feel free to contact me later. I'll put you in touch with.
And we do know from the COHO experience that community shift and change, culture change, does occur. Mm. In the first 2 years of COHO, we went from 5% of this county having a Pulse in the registry to 2 years later, 15.7% having a Pulse. So it really was a dramatic effect by being legitimized and having conversations.
Okay, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Close the hearing on palliative care and open up an informational hearing on, well, there'll be two in a row on the hepatitis C. You might join us both. We've asked the State Public Health Division to talk a bit about the epidemiology of hepatitis C. We've asked our old friend Mr. Burns, who was instrumental in writing HB 2009 that had the Pulse in it.
Pulse.
And is here doing other things.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'm Tom Burns. I'm the Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. With me is Lillian Shirley, who is the Director of Public Health for the Oregon Health Authority. We're going to tag team this presentation today because it's impossible to talk about one half of the disease without talking about the other half and the treatment. So Lillian's going to head it off and talk about the background.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Lillian Shirley, and I'm the Director of the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority. Okay. So just to set the context a little bit, the background of hepatitis C, we wanted to walk you through exactly what it is and what we're talking about in this context. So when blood from a person infected with this virus enters the body of someone else, it results in an infection in that other person, and that can result in liver disease. It is spread primarily through people who have a history of injection drug use, before 1992. When we were screening, the blood supply began. It was spread through transfusions and organ transplants. So that's a really important distinction, that timeline. It's also important to distinguish between acute and chronic disease. Acute hepatitis virus infection is a short-term illness. It occurs within the first 6 months after exposure. And while many people do go on to develop chronic disease, that's when people who are exposed go on to develop really long-term health problems. However, the outcomes of that chronic disease is influenced, and the progression of the disease is influenced by a number of factors that impact the health of the liver besides the virus itself. And it's important to just carry out, you know, and call out that there currently is no vaccine for hepatitis C. Okay. You're in charge.
All right.
Okay. All right. So I want to bring out the timeline because, again, we are talking mainly about chronic disease. And after you acquire hepatitis C virus, it's a very slow-acting disease. So it'll take 10 to 14 years before a biopsy gives you evidence of that chronic disease. There are 20 to 30 years it's predicted to develop cirrhosis in liver disease, and 25 to 30 years to go on with a progression to liver cancer. So it's very slow acting. For every 100 people infected with hepatitis C, we have projections of how this will work out for those 100 people. And these projections come from modeling methodology from the Center for Disease Control. So in the worst case scenario, 1 to 5 people will die of cirrhosis or liver cancer. And as you can see, again, it's a progression of the disease and it happens over time. So hepatitis
chronic... Can you go back to that again, please?
Yeah.
There, that one.
You start with 100, 75 to 85 will develop a chronic infection. Of those, 60 to 70 will develop chronic liver disease?
Correct.
The others won't?
Right.
Correct.
And of the 60 to 70 who have chronic liver disease, only 15 or 20 will develop cirrhosis?
Correct.
And 1 to 5 will go on?
I mean 5 to 20.
5 to 20.
Correct.
Thank you.
So here in Oregon, it's estimated that we have 95,000 people have been identified. We'll have it. That's through the modeling. We have identified 47,000 of those people. And that's this estimate of prevalence that goes back to the modeling. And we also estimate that 50% of the people who are walking around with this infection are yet to be diagnosed. Okay. The annual number of chronic diseases here, these are our data here from the state. You see the arrow pointing to 2005 because that's when we had a test that was specific for hepatitis C. So before that, you know, it doesn't mean that it wasn't in the population. It was just that we didn't know, we couldn't identify it, and we couldn't see where it was. And this has allowed us to identify who has this infection. This is a disease you'll see that is actually leveling off or getting better. It depends upon your perspective. But really, I think the message is we don't know. We just
these
don't know because
cases,
we haven't
though, yeah.
tested everyone in our
area. Is this incident? Are these new cases?
No, these are chronic cases. These are testing the population in general.
And it's going down because people are dying that fast? Or?
No, we just don't know because we've only tested we've only tested 47,000 of adults in Oregon. So we don't know if it's going down or going up because we haven't tested everybody.
Chair Green, look, the test wasn't available prior to 2005. In 2005, we started testing people.
Right.
And so you have the first bump of people who start testing. And then you get fewer and fewer people who are in front of a doctor who they don't know whether they have it. And so the number gets smaller over time. Whether it will level off or continue that decline, we don't know until we've tested everybody in the state.
Are these new cases, is my answer? Are these prevalent cases?
No.
They're prevalent cases. These are some of these people could have been living, well, you can see, 61%, 79% over age 40 years. So some of these people could be living for 20 or to 40 years.
I'll take this offline.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Excuse me.
Do you have a question?
I think I have the same question you have.
Yeah,
I'm trying to figure out
that,
what
that table just
of these
doesn't
people
make sense.
Are part of the 47,000. I think that's what I'm trying to get at.
Not everyone gets tested, so this
right.
Well, epidemiology, either you have incidence, which is the number of new cases, or you have prevalence, which is the total number. It seems to me year to year, the total number of cases can't go down unless they're dying faster than they're being.
Yeah. No, this is the number of new people who have gone through the tests, and
that's what I was
they
asking.
May have been infected 20 years ago.
So these are new cases
each year.
It's incidents.
Newly identified.
Newly identified cases.
Yeah.
It's incidents.
Yeah.
So if we add up those lines,
now
it should come to 49,000.
Yes, right.
Thank
right.
you.
Okay.
Well, one more question on reportable in 2005. My mom died of Hep C in 2002. So I know that and it was identified and diagnosable in something like 1993, I think. So why is it that we only started in 2005?
I can't answer that question, but I can.
It's a new screening.
Public policy.
This is a new screening test that is an easy test. It's a blood draw. You take the test. It comes back and says you're positive. Previous to this, it was the doctor worked with you. The doctor saw what was going on inside your body. The doctor said you have hepatitis C through whatever liver biopsies or whatever other studies they did. This is the blood test, a simple test to know whether you're positive or not.
Mr. Kenmore, did you have a question? Okay, go on.
Okay. So the next slide.
Oops, come
oops.
On. There we go.
Okay, the next slide shows the year of birth among cases of chronic hepatitis C in Oregon between the years of 2009 and 2013. So what this is showing us is back to what we talked about before, that a lot of people in this country who have hepatitis C were infected. They're in this cohort of people who were born between 1945 and 1965. That's the majority of the cases that we see today. Okay, next slide. So what are the estimates? What are they telling us about how big of a problem is this? According to the CDC, that cohort of people, affectionately known as the baby boomers, are a compromise about 27% of the population, but they do account for 75% of the hepatitis C infections in the United States, and 73% of hepatitis C-associated mortality is actually the people in this cohort, the 1945 to 1965. They are the ones that are great at risk for the hepatocellular carcinoma and other liver diseases. So, we now have a simple blood test. We can test people. The CDC recommends everyone in this age group get screened. What we know earlier, like, well, why is this? We had transmission by blood transfusions. We understand that risk now. We screen our blood supply. People were sharing needles, and they didn't really understand the risk of sharing needles until later on. And also, this is the cohort where they've reached an age where the disease is showing up. And if you go back to my prior slide, where it says it's between 20 to 30 years before you actually see some disease resulting from this. So advanced liver disease in patients with hepatitis C related to hospitalizations. Again, this is our data here in Oregon between 2008 and 2012. We've had over 3,000 hospitalizations in that period. An average of those hospitalizations every year is about 783 people are admitted to the hospital. And the next slide will break that down for you by category of liver disease. If someone goes on to have liver disease, but it's possible to slow the disease and to predict who will go on. before this end stage. So, and the next slide talks a little bit about this. This combines a few different points. It's a little, you know, busy. But you can see who had chronic hepatitis C by 2012, and then once the testing came in 2005, what we were able to learn. And we know that 78% of the hepatitis C-related liver cancer deaths were male, and 53% were in that category, 50 to 59, and 33% were in the 60 to 69 years old. So this is consistent with what we were predicting would happen over the period of time that we're talking about. So any questions on that slide? It took me a while to get my brain around that slide, so I want to pause on it a bit. So. Yeah. And this, I think, is an important point for us to understand in terms of what's going on in Oregon. These are age-adjusted death rates for both hepatitis and HIV. And between 95 and 97, you can see what happened to the HIV line. That's the black line. That's when protease inhibitors were made available. They were widely distributed. Providers knew about them. Patients got them. So what this is really saying is if we had an affordable treatment, we would see a similar decline in this disease as we've seen with the HIV epidemic, with the hepatitis C epidemic. I also think it's important for us to look at the racial differences here in Oregon. This is Oregon data. The burden of the chronic disease is in particularly in the Native American and the African American population. However, I think the greatest disparity that I'd like to call out is in the mortality. And that's your last bar there in deaths per 100,000. And you can't say this for sure, but maybe this could be a secondary result because of inadequate access to care for those clients during the period that the disease shows itself. And the next two slides, we are just going to present a little bit about the acute infections. It shows that the rates in Oregon are relatively stable. 64% of our acute, that's our new infections, are reported with injection drug use. And the next slide here shows our rate of acute with new cases. We do know that it is 2.1 times higher than the rest of the United States in Oregon. We don't know why, but we also know that it's a Western disease, that you see similar increases over other parts of the country for all of the Western states. So what are some of the things that we can do to address this public health epidemic? We can encourage screening among people born in the 1945 to 1964 cohort, where we find the highest risk populations for transmission. We can target our screening in those settings. The rest of our time, we'll look at how we could apply some of this screening methodology for the best outcomes for all Oregonians, and what are some of the strategies that we can employ to address this public health problem in our state. So I'm going to talk about something called monitoring or surveillance, we call it in public health lingo. We think we need funds to track the burden in Oregon to understand where these trends are, where the differences are, and who's progressing. Some people don't progress. Other people do progress. What are the other variables for people go on to get cirrhosis, liver cancer, and investigate trends to really understand what are the drivers for the health disparities, both geographic as well as racial, ethnic, and other disparities that we see in this population, so that we can effectively target our screening and do prevention and disease management. So what do I mean by prevention? You know, there's a lot of interventions that actually have been proven in other areas of public health and with other diseases that can be applied to this epidemic. We can address opiate dependency, including decreasing our prescription drug diversion and prevent transition from oral opiate misuse into injection drug use. We can have programs and interventions with communities to work on that. Promote access to sterile syringes. We do have a law here in Oregon, but equitable syringe access is not necessarily across the state and to different populations. And we can support harm reduction techniques. This last strategy has led to interrupting cases of IV drug spread of HIV. And because out here in the West, we've been early to adopt those strategies, we have some of the lowest rates of intravenous drug transmission of HIV in the country. So we can apply that to this other disease. We can other ideas that come up, if we had a targeted, consistent effort to link people that we know are already infected once they're tested, to make sure that they get a medical home, that they're in care, that they stay in care, so that their disease, their infection doesn't progress to liver disease. Educate, decreasing alcohol use, provide access to drug and alcohol treatment programs, you know, prioritize people who we know are going to progress into these treatment programs, and then decreasing barriers to care. These are standard across many of the public health programs that we have and the alcohol and drug treatment programs that we already have. And also, again, back to monitoring, identify who could really benefit best from treatment. To look at liver disease progression and how to decrease transmission. Who do we know are at highest risk of transmitting this disease to even more people in our community, and really target them for treatment options? So that actually, after management, I turn it over. What are those options?
There it is. So
what are
treatment
those
options.
Treatment options?
Okay. I mean, we have a disease. It's a public health disease. It's been out there for a number of years. And
Who are you, Phil?
Oh, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs. I thought I did that at the very beginning, Mr. Chair. I apologize. We have a number of treatment options. Prior to 1998, there were very few. You got the disease, your liver got in trouble. Ultimately, you probably had a liver transplant. In 1998, we saw the first drugs come on the market, interferon and ribavirin. It was a 48-week therapy, where you had to take the drugs every single day in order to make it work. And it had about a 30% cure rate, and then the cost was about $20,000. In 2001, we had PEG interferon plus ribavirin, which was also 48-week treatment, 42% cure rate for $38,000. In 2001, the first generations of protease inhibitors came on the market to treat this disease. They were prescribed in addition to the previous drugs, but it cut the treatment to 24 weeks, much more compliant, and we saw a 69% cure rate, but the price of the drug was up to $82,000. Then in November of last year, the FDA approved Olysio, which when combined with Pegasus and ribavirin was a 24-week treatment, but an 80% cure rate, and was an $86,000 option for payers. And then we come to Sovaldi, which was approved in December of last year. It's, again, prescribed in combination with two of the previous drugs. It's gone through six clinical trials, had for 1,947 patients, had a 90% plus cure rate. People far smarter than me said that's a great rate, but they have a little bit of concerns about these studies. One is they're not longitudinal. That is, at the end of the 12 weeks, you're cured, and the company did not follow up with the patients to know whether the patient remained cured, whether the disease may have been hiding in the body someplace. There were also no head-to-head studies, so we don't know whether Sovaldi is better than with previous drugs is better than Olysio with previous drugs. There's been none of the head-to-head studies. It's also priced at $84,000, $1,000 per pill, plus the other $10,000 for the previous drugs that need to be added to it, and it was a 12-week treatment. So it's a great drug, expensive, produced some great results. OHP, what you're worried about, what you have to pay for. As of March, we did back and did a very quick study and identified 5,600, at least 5,600 patients who had hepatitis C in the OHP database. I say at least for two reasons. One is we took a snapshot of 2013. If you got treated for hepatitis C, you were on our list. If you did not get treated, you were not on the list. So if you got the disease 5 years ago, you were doing just fine, had no treatments, you wouldn't be counted. We also did not have access to the 300,000 lives that joined the OHP in January, so we do not know what those lives looked like. So the 5,600 is an at least number. 5,100 of them are in CCOs, 600 are fee-for-service. If we provided the drug to every single one of those that we've identified, it's a $480 million liability for treatments. The exposure could be as quickly as prescribers prescribe the drug. We don't know how quickly that is, but we do know that if you see the company's press releases that the drug has had a great uptake. This is offset, and I will tell you it is offset. So the taxpayers aren't paying the full $480. There is around $112 million in rebates. The problem is that the rebates come to the state, not to the CCOs, and that's a quirk of the way the CCO rebate law works together. They write the check, and I collect the rebates, and we have a very difficult time of getting those rebates to the CCOs because of the 2% cap and the agreements we have with CMS. We haven't given up, but for right now, it's the CCOs who are really at risk for this, while the state gets $112 million. We saw this disease coming. Where am I going? There it is. Oops, the slide's missing. Oops. There it is. Yeah. We saw this disease coming, these drugs coming, and the P&T committee, which is the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee that sets the policy around how drugs are prescribed in this state, had its first meeting in January and did the initial sort of, you must prescribe on label, you must only use the drug the way the FDA has it, and we put that in place in January. We then sent the word out to the prescribers in the community and said, help us. You know, if in fact this is as good as it is, are we going to face this tidal wave? Or what's going on in the community? And they came to us and said, because of the slow progression in this disease, you really only need to treat stages 3 and 4 fibrosis, and that you can wait for those people at that stage. So the fibrosis. It's, okay. My note says fibrosis. Sorry. It reduced the cost from $480 million to about $160 million liability. And then in May, we said, okay, so assume we were even going to allow that to move forward. One of the problems is these patients need to be ready to treat. Are they in a situation where they will take the drug daily for the 12 weeks? Are they in a situation where they are no longer abusing alcohol or illicit drugs? Do they have a support network to help them through this process? And so we put a readiness to treat standard in place. In July, we went back to the community and we said, it's still too big. What can we do to narrow this? And they suggested, well, if you really just get the stage 4 clients, patients, that you will keep them from needing liver transplants, you will save money, you will reduce the disease, and you will spread the cost out over about a 10 or 12 year time period, treating those people who are the sickest and starting to shrink the reservoir so it doesn't continue to expand in the regular community. That's a $40 million cost. And then in September, we met again. We reviewed the latest information, made some modifications to the PA criteria, and those PA criteria are in place and are available for the CCOs and our fee-for-service to follow. There's also the Health Evidence-Based Review Commission, or HERC. They have the ability to decide whether treatment should be above or below the line. Hepatitis C has been, for a number of years, a disease that is above the line, and the general policy is all treatments for an above-the-line disease are considered above the line. The Value-Based Benefit Subcommittee met to look at these drugs and ask the question whether the cost-benefit analysis for treating these drugs would in fact provide the return on investment that was necessary to leave the drug above the line. The subcommittee actually made a recommendation to the full committee and said it does. We want it above the line, but we want some treatment guidelines. We want some guidelines associated with this, saying if you're going to treat with this drug, you must follow the state's P&T guidelines. The full HERC met, and at the request of a number of CCOs, they asked that the state guidelines not be adopted, that the drug simply be left above the line. The committee decided not to take a formal action on that and tabled the decision for some subsequent action. So at this point in time, all Hep C drug treatments are above the line benefits with no guidelines associated with them.
Tom, did you say the CCOs wanted it?
Some CCOs did not want restrictions on how the drug were prescribed. Hmm. They thought they could come up with their own guidelines and wanted to develop their own guidelines. We had a statewide guideline that had gone through the P&T committee in a public process.
They weren't against guidelines.
They wanted their own guidelines, not our guidelines. Right. Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the next steps, the P&T committee will meet each month. This becomes important because there are new drugs coming out. In fact, on October 9th, this is supposed to be the new Gilead drug that has come out. It will be a combination of drugs. So instead of taking multiple drugs together, multiple pills, you'll take one pill. The new drug approvals that are anticipated by the end of the year may be as costly or maybe less costly. There was a press release that was just came out from a payer that said that they've learned that the Gilead price for the new combination launched in October will be around $95,000. Whether that is true or not is
waste to be. 24 weeks, correct?
12 weeks. It's still 12.
I think that one is for 24 weeks. It's more expensive, but for I'm sorry. The current is for 12 weeks.
No, Sovaldi is a 12-week.
Yeah.
12 times 7 is 84. $1,000 a pill, $84,000. Yeah. I don't, again, we haven't seen it. We don't know what it's going to look like, but the assumption is it's a 12-week. It will be a 12-week cure. Although they have told me that if you treat people in stage 1 and 2, you only need an 8-week cure. But you have to treat people in 1 and 2, which may not need the disease, the treatments now. And we've encouraged the provider advisory group to continue to meet, to continue to talk about what is actually going on in the community and to give us help in the guidelines. So final thoughts, it's a public health disease. Increasing screening and disease management is very important. If we can get the reservoir narrowed, eliminated, the disease is not going to continue to spread. Stopping the spread through needle exchange, better information, better education, better connecting to treatments is a good plus. Curing the disease is what we really want to do. If we could cure this disease, it, like other diseases, would go away and we wouldn't be worried about this. But the question for you is, how do you want to pay for it? With that, we'll be happy to take any questions.
Just in case anybody has any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I could. I'm just wondering. I'd be kind of curious to know how many people are on other assistance that are coming down with hepatitis C versus people who aren't on government assistance, to compare the two, and then maybe one of the other incentives could be that we do drug screening for people that receive the Oregon Trail card, and that way if they don't pass the drug test, they wouldn't receive the Oregon Trail card and other benefits from the government if they are using intravenous needles and things like that. So something to look at. To be put up on the slide here as well.
To the extent that people are not, sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, to the extent that people are not sharing needles, it will go a long ways towards solving this disease.
The notion is you check people to find out if they're sick, and if they're sick, you take away their benefits?
No. If they're using drugs, then they wouldn't receive their benefits.
No, if they're using drugs, you really don't want to treat them. That's
true.
I think that's pretty clear because. Well, there's a notion it's a cure. It's not a permanent cure. It's a cure that...
Because they're going to come down with it again anyway.
Down with it again, and you don't want to be treating people who are active drug users. I think that's in any guideline.
Well, that would help stop transmission.
I wonder
if you have any cost estimates on people who are F1 or F2 or F3 below the F4 recommendation that was on the table for a while on what the health care costs would be and what the economic costs would be compared to that $86,000 or $95,000.
Chair Greenlick, co-chair Kenny Geyer, it's a very valid question. And if you go back to slide 10, and if I could figure out how to do this, well, now see, I've screwed it up.
Well, you had a hospitalization, but
these are the hospitalization costs for the various parts of the disease.
Right.
People have done studies. There was a study called ICER that came out of California that asked the very question you're asking, which is there a return on investment by killing the disease? Mm-hmm. And their answer was, because the disease spreads so slowly, it would take more than 20 years to recoup your front-end investment. And as far as I know, that's the only study that I'm aware of that has asked the question you're asking.
So I'll just say that one of the conversations I've had today about this particular issue is how can you spread the costs out over a longer period of time, because it certainly seems to make sense from a public health point of view to try to nip this in the bud to the extent possible. It's called the silent epidemic because so many people have it and may continue to spread it while we don't see the cirrhosis of the liver or the end stages. And so if we can try to cut it as a public health prevention measure before it, number one, gets spread, and number two, develops into things that cost a lot in the healthcare system, loss of employment, things like that, makes sense. The big question is, how do you do that up front? And, you know, I would love to see, of course, Gilead coming down in its cost and the degree to which you can negotiate, as other states have, in trying to bring down that cost is something I heartily encourage our state to do. Also, if we can look at any kind of innovative models with social impact bonds or those kinds of things, what can you save in our healthcare system by investing in treatment now that might be able to be recouped?
But part of the question is, if we had unlimited resources, there's no question what you'd do. You'd arrest everybody, round them up, and treat them. But the issue is, do we spend money on this, or do we spend that money some other way? Would there be another public health measure that, in fact, could produce? I mean, for example, you could prevent a lot of premature children with that same amount of a couple hundred million, is that what we're talking about? Something like that. So, yeah, if we had unlimited resources, it's clear what you do. It's not clear for us because we don't have an extra $200 million. And if we did, is this where we'd really spend it? I think you might make a different selection on how you spend it.
But I do think other states have brought the costs significantly down in terms of their negotiating.
Yeah. Chair Greenlick, Representative.
You were quoted in the paper to follow this up. And I tried to follow up with Gilead today, who told me everything was fine, that you had a problem with the negotiation with them for the...
Yeah. So, Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, we met with Gilead late last week, the first face-to-face meeting we've had with them. We do sit behind a buying group, the sovereign state buying group, that has did receive an offer from Gilead. The offer said that they would provide rebates. But remember, we get a 23.1% rebate just off the top, so that does bring the cost down to $63 million for the taxpayers. It doesn't solve the fact that I get the rebate and CCOs don't, which is another problem that has to be worked out. But they did offer an additional rebate. That rebate was, against an $84,000 drug, not insubstantial, but it also said that we could have no restrictions on the drug, which meant that anybody who wanted to prescribe the drug could prescribe the drug, that they would not have to require that it go through a hepatologist or a gastroenterologist, that it was that any GP that chose to prescribe the drug could prescribe the drug, that it would be open to all providers, all people with the disease between stage one and stage four. And again, even those costs are still in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
They seem to think they were willing to negotiate that.
Yeah,
they
and
seem
I heard
to
something
be
different
that today.
From them today. So.
No, they acknowledged what they said, but they said we have confidentiality problems, but they need to talk to us some more.
I'm perfectly willing to talk to them. Like I said, we got it late last week. We're running some numbers. We'll have continued conversations with them. But frankly, we need some sense of how much it's going to impact the Oregon Health Authority's budget and the overall cost of health care.
Well, thank you, guys.
Could I ask just a quick question?
Yes.
So I'm trying to understand a little bit better. It seems as you went through and discussed this about the signs of people most likely to have hepatitis C and be in trouble, but it talks about this whole cohort group, and it talks about the CDC recommending that they all get tested. So what that leads me to think, is there something else? So from a standpoint of who's going to end up with this disease, or most likely, is there something else besides those things you described that within that cohort group might be driving the fact that they might have hepatitis C if their recommendation is everybody gets tested?
Well, part of the problem is, remember, we just got good diagnostic testing. So that one example would be, and this is actually based on a true story, you have someone who in the 1980s had a cesarean section and had a blood transfusion. This person is now past childbearing years, probably, and could be hepatitis C positive, wouldn't know until they got tested. Now, having had my children around that cohort, I'll just say, then I could be counseled to do things like, not drink, that kind of work. So it doesn't mean that there are things that I can do to decrease my risk of progressing through the disease, but I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know that I'm in that pool of people. So that's part of the reason, I think, for the universal testing result. And, we just looked it up. This is an over-the-counter test now. You can get it at the drugstore. You take your blood and you can send it in. So it is way different technology and circumstances that we had even in the 90s for this, as Tom says, public health problem.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just real quick, Tom, you might have said it and I missed it just because I was talking to my new member here, but they offered rebates. What was the amount of the rebate? Was it 25%, 50%? I mean, because is there some way we could work this back in? Because I'm kind of curious on what that rebate was that was offered to us, because I know we receive 50% and 70% rebates. So even though the pill's $1,000, was it actually $300 to the state, or what was the amount to the state? Because that rebate could be funneled back into the system for the CCOs, and we could come up with a creative way with all the members sitting here to do that.
Yeah. Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, I'm uncomfortable answering with a number. As I understand the federal rebate law, I can't answer that question in public. In public.
Julia said the same thing. So.
That they gave a number to you? No, that they can't answer in public. So that's the problem. It's federal rebate law won't allow me to answer your question.
But right now we get what?
This is the problem with the healthcare system, when nobody knows what anything costs or what it comes out to.
It's protected, right? It's part of
Well, wait a minute. Let's finish with you.
We currently get a rebate of 23.1%, and that we will get regardless of whether we enter into any contracts or not. The additional state supplemental rebate beyond that is the number that
is... So we're 21.3 now.
23.1.
23.
Brings the cost of the drug to the taxpayers down to the $63,000 range.
And the problem with this whole thing is we're not only talking about Medicaid, which is a big piece paid by the federal government. The state guidelines are going to be used by everybody. So the other insurance companies are very interested in the state's decision because it's going to affect everybody. Well,
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering why we can't say, you know what, we'll pay $500 for up to $500 and the patient's responsible for anything above and beyond that.
Because you can't do that under Medicaid. So. Okay, we'll close the public hearing. Informational hearing, not a public hearing. I'll keep reading the Oregonian and find out more about what's going on. And I'll open up a public hearing an information hearing for the progress report on the study of the basic health plan. And while Dr. Smith is joining us, let me take the last item on the agenda. The last item on the agenda is committee requests for legislative concepts. As usual, my position is anybody wants a legislative concept as a committee bill, I'm happy to do it. If you want one, get to me and Sandy by Friday?
No, Monday.
By Monday?
22nd.
Yeah, if you have something you would like to be a committee report, a committee request, get it to us. Get it to us by Friday.
Sure.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. And I'm also here on behalf of our coalition. That's the Inclusion Affordability Innovation Coalition. In interest of time, because I know it's been a long meeting, long day, I included my testimony from February that I sent in electronically. And I just really, I'm here today to say that this is basically, as the chair said, it's a progress report on where we are. I do want to say that we've had a very good working relationship with the Oregon Health Authority on that. They've been very inclusive. We've also talked to the consultants, and we have a big meeting coming up next week where we'll see the draft report. So just to wrap up my remarks, as we look forward to coming back and talking with you more in detail about what that report shows us.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, Janine Smith. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the Oregon Health Authority and oversee the Office of Health Policy and Research. And as John said, we've been proceeding to go forward with House Bill 4109's recommendation from you all to pursue a independent study of the basic health plan, which is a unique feature that was part of the Affordable Care Act to pull out a certain population that is eligible currently for the exchange into a specific supported program that the federal government is offering. I gave you a three-page summary that you should have in your materials, and just to know, we went through an RFP. We have on board sort of a dual team of researchers from the Urban Institute and Wakely Consulting together to provide us the information. We've been working with the advocates to have them be involved during the course of modeling as they do their work. And as John said, they're coming to us with their preliminary first look at the findings next month. I just wanted to bring your attention to that the Medicaid Advisory Committee has been doing a lot of work around churn, which is really the basic underlying questions that the basic health plan is an option for. And there is a detailed report that they have completed. I summarized in my remarks sort of what their findings were, and we can certainly make sure it's online. That's maybe a good resource. They did a really nice job. We had some free consulting from some national experts on what churn was. We've done some analysis of how many people would be moving between the Medicaid program and qualified health plans on the exchange, and sort of what does that mean, and churn means many things. And so I would turn your attention to that as a resource as you go forward to interpret the results of our report. There are a few states that are looking very earnestly at the basic health plan as an option because they've been covering people at a higher income level prior to the Affordable Care Act. So they're looking at the basic health plan as an option to continue to do that in a different way. Other states are looking at it similar to us in terms of what does it mean for people in that sort of just above Medicaid eligibility, and whether they can afford to be on the exchange or not in certain populations that don't qualify to be in Medicaid, that are lower, that don't get the Medicaid services. So wanted to just give you that update that we're progressing, and we'll be back in November. We'll have the final report ready for you by your November days.
We'll be back.
Or December days, sorry. We'll have the report in November, so it'll be ready for you to preview.
Isn't that lively?
So I have a question about another study bill, and that you might be able to answer, because I've had a lot of inquiries from constituents, and that has to do with House Bill 3260, which was the bill that was authorizing to look at the paying, how we fund the healthcare system. One of the concepts that people go around is a single payer system. And if I remember the bill correctly, when we authorized it, the part of the goal was it wasn't spend any public funds on it, but there were to be private donations. But we're running to the end of that time frame. We talked about that, and so I didn't know if there was anybody could.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, basic health was also part of 3260, but what advocates decided that we would do is we would press forward with a request for a study bill just for basic health, because 3260 requires private funding of those studies, which I would love to see personally. to see those studies go forward. But meanwhile, what advocates were thinking, we were being pretty practical about saying that basic health is a tool that's already available under the ACA, and there's been a workup, and as Dr. Smith talked about, the fact that other states have been involved in looking at basic health very closely. And because one of our coalition has to do with inclusion, you know, one of the features of basic health that's really important is the coverage for legally present residents, which is an important part of our coalition discussion.
So you chose, just so I have this clear, so we chose just to proceed with that portion of it at this point?
Yes, that was what advocates requested, and the legislature funded was a funded study for basic health.
Thank you all. We'll close this informational hearing. Before I adjourn, let me just give you a brief update on the task force on the future of public health in the state. The task force has done an amazing job. We'll be voting next week on the final report. The bill will come to us, and it will be a bill to modernize public health, to prepare it for dealing with the kind of things we talked about today, and Ebola and disaster planning and a variety of other things. We'll ultimately take a fair chunk of money, but it won't in the first biennium. And I think you'll find it an extraordinary report. We'll have a bill, I assume, in this committee, maybe the first bill we work on. So it's Chair Tammy Bainey, the commissioner in Crook County, did an extraordinary job chairing the committee. And Deschutes County, that's it. What did I say? Anyway, Deschutes is right. And she really did a great job. It was a great committee. With that, I will adjourn.
Nice speech, Jim.
Remember, we need, if you have any LCs you want us to submit, get it to us. If not, you're on your own. And we are adjourned. Get it to us. If not, you're on your own.